sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight we are at the Hyatt Regency Hotel here in the nation's capital for the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I think this is like our fifth year, I think, here. We've been doing this quite some time, and, you know, always interesting to come out and talk to folks, especially as 2014 round the corner, the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, or as it's known, Obamacare. Which I kind of, you know, I said right from the beginning, they should have taken that and made that the official name of it. Buttons, T-shirts, everywhere. No, it seems they've come around to it, and we have now embraced the whole Obamacare thing. How is this going to affect us in Pennsylvania with a governor that says, no, we're not going to do it? Which I got to be honest, quite happy about. I like the idea that the guy who is totally against it will not be the guy setting it up. So we'll talk about how that's going to affect Pennsylvania, how it's going to affect low-income folks and the uninsured here in our state. We'll see where this goes. Big news today, though. If you saw the news conference yesterday, it's all about consumer choice, except for health care, of course. If you want to buy liquor, you want booze, man, this Pennsylvania will be the state. There will be booze everywhere. Booze, gambling, you name it. We will be the vice state. Keystone, no more. We're going to be the state of the vice. And it's pretty amazing to me. I mean, the consumer choice. Yesterday, if you saw the press conference, you saw the governor come out of his little hole. Every once in a while, I didn't even know it was Groundhog Day yet. He comes out of his little hole. He with a whole bunch of other privateers and another state asset on the chopping block. And he says, well, you know, why do we have to deal with an antiquated liquor system? Explain to me, you're the guy in charge of it. You could, if it's antiquated and it's broken like you said, you could fix it. You don't have to sell it off. And I found a lot of what he said really just very amazing. Hypocritical. One of my favorite parts is, and I don't know about you, I don't know how many times you've had the conversation, because I've never had it until last night when I asked some of the parents of the girls on my daughter's basketball team about how many times you've had this conversation where, gee, I just wish there was more liquor. I wish I could just walk across the street and there'd be liquor everywhere. You know, kind of like here in the nation's capital where you could, on every corner there's dry cleaning and liquor and sandwiches and liquor. That's the vision of Pennsylvania. But when I listen to the governor, and I guess one of my big questions is, who the hell is he hanging out with? Who are his friends where he has this conversation all the time? I have it all the time, he says. Explain to me. Where is that conversation? I just wish I could get beer right next to my Tic Tacs. I wish Jack and Tic Tacs were on the impulse aisle. Have you ever had that? Because I have not. You know, for me, alcohol is an adult item. And I guess my problem is I've turned into, and as I've said this before, I've turned into this hypocritical animal known as a parent. As a kid growing up in Cleveland, liquor was available. You could walk into the 7-Eleven, you could walk into the gas station, and it was right there next to the chewing gum. Pick it up, right out the door with it, which we did often. So my question then becomes, you know, who's going to, when this happens, because I think it's probably going to happen. I think the language that they've taken, it's about choice. It's about expanding opportunity. And a lot of people do. They want to be able to go and buy a six-pack at the grocery store. And that's about it. But they're going to go all in. And understand, you, me, the taxpayers, we're going to get screwed in this. This will be a boon for big corporations. This will be a boon for the big box retailers and the supermarket chains and the newspapers and all of the people who sell the advertising. Lots of stuff there. But average taxpayers, you're screwed. People who have the existing beer distributorships, get ready. Grab the ankles because you're next. The reality is the $1 billion that this governor said we're going to get out of it, not happening. And what I like about it is, and maybe this is just, it's just me thinking that we should be funding education and senior programs in a different way. I don't believe that we should be funding this stuff through vice spending. You know, and he linked liquor and education. Again, I thought it was going to be liquor and pensions. I did. I thought he was going to bring up the whole pension issue and say, you know, we need to sell these the liquor stores so we can fill the gap in the pensions. Didn't do that. Tried that with the budget. Found out that was a loser. So now we're going to go with the children. Going to exploit the children because, you know, our children, they're our most precious asset, our governor said. Most precious asset. This is a guy who cut $2 billion from public education, but now they're our most precious asset when you want to hock off the liquor store. Are you kidding me? It's mind-blowing on so many levels. But when you look at it purely, step back, just walk away from the emotional, on a purely business scale. This is a failure. We're going to sell off this asset, and if you look to Washington State, where we have a live experiment right before our eyes to see exactly what's going to happen, you've got New Jersey across the border saying, hey, you know, $50,000 for a license. I don't know where Corbett thinks he's going to get all of this money for these licenses. Because if you look at New Jersey, you look at Washington, like $30,000 a license, the numbers just don't add up. And then you run it through. Then you go down the line and you go, okay, we're going to have more enforcement. We're going to have to hire more cops. We're going to have to hire more people to go into these stores and audit. You're going to have to do all of these things. It's going to cost us, the taxpayers, much more money. Understand that. Because right now you've got folks who their gig is, my license is everything. And I go back to when I was a kid, you know, the local corner store, you could, 14, 15, I was buying whatever I wanted. And again, I go back to the whole hypocritical parent thing. Don't want it. So as we go down this road, and you know, another asset on the chopping block, you go, explain to me how this is going to be good for taxpayers. It's not. This is pure ideology, pure and simple, but it is what it is. One of the things I loved about the governor's press conference yesterday, there are a bunch of politicians in the room. And he blurts out, well, there are a lot of people in this room who know a lot of the private sector. Reporters and politicians know a lot about the private sector. Corbett knows a lot about the private sector. Has he ever had a private sector job? I don't believe so. I know he'll have a nice one when he leaves. He'll be well taken care of, especially by the liquor and gambling people. And the gas people, don't forget them as well. Think about all the assets we've given away. And then you look at the news reports yesterday. The news reports yesterday, austerity working, right? The economy actually shrunk. And then we find out how much government spending has dropped. And you go, explain to how the government works again, Mr. Politician, the guy who's pushing for austerity. Here in Pennsylvania, we've actually lost jobs. And now this is the guy who understands the economy, right? Understands how everything works, understands how everything's put together. We've lost 20,000 jobs in education. We're not going to be creating jobs in healthcare because he's not going to expand Medicaid. Explain to me what he understands about job creation. I'm sorry, job creation doesn't come with making liquor a commodity that you put on a store shelf. That's actually going to lose more jobs. But here again, it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me that here's a guy who doesn't get it. And I look at reports now. And this is what, I go back to 2009 when Obama took office. One of the things I said right from the beginning is this has got to be the guy, my hope for him was that he would be the guy who saved work in this country. And I advocated at that time, instead of passing the Lilly Ledbetter Act, to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, get people some collective bargaining rights. I look at this new report out by the Corporation for Enterprise Development. And what they've concluded is that almost half of U.S. households, this is something we all know, instinctively know, we know our friends, our neighbors, our families, we're in the same boat, most of us. Almost half of the nation living on the edge, right there at the precipice of financial collapse. They have almost no savings. They have nothing to fall back on. So if you have a job loss, if you have a health crisis, if you have a something that comes, the car breaks down, whatever, the roof falls in, whatever, you're done. That close to poverty, that close to the street. And, you know, it was always, you know, the statement, well, how many people are 2 weeks away? This report, lays it out. It's the 2013 Assets and Opportunity Scorecard that defines these families as liquid asset poor. And what that means is that they lack the adequate savings to cover basic expenses at the federal poverty level for just 3 months. If you have one of those things that happen, you lose a job, you get sick, a family member gets sick, something comes up, 3 months. And you go through the different incomes, and you know, the further down the income scale you go, the closer you are to that, well, to that curb. And, you know, as I look at being here in D.C. for this healthcare conference, healthcare to me, one of those things that you cannot possibly be without to be a member of the middle class. It is impossible in my view to be in the middle class without health security. Absolutely, totally impossible. And what gets me is you've got voices, people like Corbett, a lot of these right-wing governors around the country who are saying, no, we're not going to expand. And the people who believe it, going, hey, well, we have national health care. You could go to the emergency room and they'll take care of you. And that may be true if you break your leg or you cut your arm open. That may be true for that. They will take care of you at that very moment. But if you've got a long-term illness, if you've got diabetes, for instance, not much there for you. They'll stabilize you. They'll make sure you're not going to die at that moment. And then, like in California, Skid Row, here you go. And I guess, you know, as I look at this, it brings me back to our governor. It brings me back to the whole liquor economy. Because if you listen to the governor yesterday, liquor and gambling, that's the future of Pennsylvania. You know, and I love one of the statements by one of the front groups in our state, the Citizen Alliance of Pennsylvania, a well-funded front group. They won't tell us who they get their money from, but they got a lot of it. They said the privatization of liquor sales opens the door for millions of dollars in new business investment in Pennsylvania. And I go, really? Having Jack next to the Tic Tacs at the little checkout, that's gonna grow our economy? I don't think so. Quick break, right back from Washington, D.C. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
And take money. All they want to do is
Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Education battle in Seattle over standardized measures of academic performance, or MAP tests, is escalating, with the Seattle School District threatening 10-day suspensions for teachers unless they administer the tests by February 22nd. Both the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers are supporting the Seattle teachers in their uprising against the MAP tests. NEA President Dennis Van Roekel says it's a defining moment within the education profession as teachers take a stand against what the NEA calls flawed tests not aligned with school curriculums that aren't good for students or teachers. Chris McBride is academic dean at Seattle's Garfield High School.
With me today are just some of the teachers who have decided to take a really strong stand against what we all know is an unnecessary expense and a drain on our very few and precious resources. More importantly, however, our students are not benefiting from this test. In fact, it's hurting many of our students in our most fragile populations, as well as those kids who need more class time, not less class time.
Jesse Agapian is a teacher at Garfield.
We have a different destination here. Teachers at Garfield and schools across Seattle have a different destination for their kids, and that destination is not on the map. Our destination is a destination of creativity. Our destination is a destination of critical thinking. We want to teach our kids to solve real problems they see in the community. And our stand against this MAP test is teaching them that.
Hundreds of United Mine Workers of America members and their supporters rallied this week at Peabody Energy headquarters in St. Louis to protest a long-term scheme to strip critical health benefits away from miners, retirees, and their families. UMWA President Cecil Roberts was arrested in the protests. The union says Patriot Coal's bankruptcy case in federal court is being used to take away the hard-earned health benefits of thousands of miners. Patriot was spun off from Peabody. Roberts says this is a sickening display of corporate greed that has overstepped the bounds of decency. He says UMWA will continue to fight so active and retired miners don't have to lay awake at night wondering if they can survive the next week, month, or year without health benefits. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Yes, liquor. We need more of it. Liquor on every corner. And what I find really just amazing, you look at, and I'm waiting for the day. I can't wait for the picture. Right next to the Tic Tacs, the big bottle of Jack Daniels. And what I love about Jack Daniels, it is brewed. It is created in a place where they cannot drink Jack Daniels where they make it. That just blows my mind. But here in Pennsylvania, it's going to be everywhere. And you know, as I said before, you know, as this horrible monster, this hypocritical monster known as a parent, I don't know that I want my kids having that kind of access that I did. I'm just sorry. It doesn't work for me. We are here in Washington, D.C., in the nation's capital for the Families USA Healthcare Conference. And, you know, what I like about coming to these things, you get a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different angles on who benefits, who's going to pay, where this is going to go. Like I've said from the beginning, I wish there was so much more. I was a single-payer guy. Medicare for All seemed to be reasonable. Our governor talks about choice. Give me a choice, buy Medicare or buy a private plan, let them compete. Seemed very simple to me. But this is the route we're going. The question is, how do we make sure those 50 million uninsured, 100 million underinsured, get the coverage they need? I've got Gordon Bonnieman. He's an attorney and member of the Tennessee Justice Center, former Families USA board member here at the conference. Gordon, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You know, I look at all of these folks who are uninsured and underinsured, and you go, how do we get them to the point to where they have the kind of security that those of us who have insurance have to maybe be in the middle class? Because I've said numerous times, there's no way I believe anyone can be in the middle class without that security.
Well, you can't even be in the upper middle class. I mean, I've represented, my background is I work for a public interest law firm, but I've spent all my career starting out representing low-income people, but increasingly middle-income people. I've represented doctors, airline pilots, lawyers, accountants who could not get health insurance because of pre-existing conditions, doctors and their staffs. Because either they had pre-existing conditions, they had a kid who was born with serious medical problems. Anymore, you do not have to be literally low income. And, of course, as we know, most of the uninsured in this country are working themselves or they're in working families. The compact that used to be there that if you worked and you played by the rules, you would have health security. That's tattered. That's shredded. It's gone.
Yeah,
and we've got to get back there.
I'm with you. But, you know, for me, I've always been against the concept of employer-based health care because, you know, at the end of the day, now you're tied to that employer. You have no portability. And as you've said, you know, you get a pre-existing condition. You have insurance. You can't really move.
I've talked to employers who had this moral dilemma of, you know, small employers with a small work group, and one of their staff, maybe somebody who's been there for a long time that they feel very close to, has a child, and that child is born with serious medical problems, and suddenly the insurance company comes to them and says, you know, we'll keep covering you, but everybody's premiums are going to double next year. So you can either throw that person out of the lifeboat or you risk everybody loses their coverage. That's a terrible dilemma. That's the way the game has been played increasingly, and that's going to change.
No, I played, I'd say rigged, you know, more than anything.
Right.
And the whole point is to, in my opinion, and we heard a lot during the whole debate over Obamacare that, oh, it's going to lead to rationing and death panels. And I would argue that we've already had rationing and death panels. It's what we've lived through for the last at least 15, 20 years.
Well, I've lost so many clients who lost their lives because they did not have insurance. Or because they were underinsured. That whole phenomenon of people who were walking around with a piece of plastic in their wallet and thinking that they're secure, and they don't know until they try to use it all the holes that are in it. And I've seen that tragedy play out among people that I've represented and known personally over and over and over again.
And that's an interesting point you bring up, Gordon, because, you know, I've met a couple of people who, you know, I had insurance and I never thought I needed it, never went to the doctor. Because I think we're a society that unless we're, I know I am. I'm one of these people, I got to be almost on my deathbed before I'll go to the doctor. And my producer will attest to that, because I was actually writhing on the floor in pain at one point before I went. But that, you know, we have this card, and we don't really know what's in it. And I've met so many people who said, you know, I didn't realize there was a $2,000 deductible and all of this stuff along the way, and it broke them. And you end up looking at bankruptcy.
Well, of course, it's the leading cause of personal bankruptcy in the United States, and it has been for decades, that is uninsured medical expenses. I had appendicitis a couple of years ago. I have got great coverage. My wife works for the state of Tennessee. It's the best coverage in the state. We had $10,000 worth of uninsured expenses at the end of that misadventure. You know, that's great coverage.
An appendix?
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost in and out.
Yeah. I mean, it was a little bit tricky, but that can happen to anybody.
Right.
I was fortunate. We were able to afford that. It wasn't fun, but we were able to afford it. But $10,000 is financial ruin to so many working families.
Well, I mean, there was just a report out, you know, yesterday that came out that said, you know, almost half of the nation, you know, they don't have the liquid assets to make it 3 months in the event that they lose a job, that they get sick, that they have some economic catastrophe. And as you go further down the socioeconomic ladder, that 3 months becomes 2-3 weeks.
Right. Well, I mean, the watchword right now for our healthcare system is, for God's sake, don't step on a banana peel.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can step on a banana peel by getting hit by a car, getting sick. I mean, you know, we don't have control over that stuff. And I'm very excited about the Affordable Care Act.
So this is going to correct some of that. Because
yes.
I've got to be honest with you. I said from the beginning, I'm a single-payer guy. This just seems to me that we're, you know, and I heard someone earlier say it's, you know, it's like a Travelocity. You're going to have a whole thing of choice. And when you get into that choice thing, well, then you go, well, how little can I afford to get by on? And that's what worries me, that we're going to have people going, well, I can only afford this, and I'll take these risks. And then we're almost in the same
boat. Well, I'll tell you, Rick, if we're here next year having this conversation and the exchanges will have gone into effect January 1st, hopefully the Medicaid reforms will have taken effect in Pennsylvania and in my state. I can tell you there will be stories every day about how messy it is. You don't do large-scale reform without there being some clutter and some mishaps, and that's just reality. So people need to be patient. But it is, I think, an enormous step forward towards solving a huge problem for the country and a huge problem for ordinary Americans. I would have been happy with single payer. I mean, I work every day in a system that is fragmented and crazy and trying to figure out how to make this thing work. It's got a lot of wheels and moving parts. But the analogy I like is to the telephone system. You can't shut down the telephone system and say, let's rewire it so that it won't have these wires that have gone all over the place since it's been operating for 150 years. You got to work from what you've got.
Right.
And I think that's why the approach that's being taken, built on employer insurance, which I'm not a big fan of, but that's what we've got. We can't disrupt everything. I think what it is it's the country saying, we have a problem that's bigger than any of us. It affects all of us, and we, the people, need to come up with a way of addressing it. And we'll fix it going forward when we run into bumps in the road. But at least now we have a framework for doing that. And I am extraordinarily proud of us as a nation for finally stepping up and saying what we as a nation have done in many other contexts, which is take those problems that are bigger than any of us and deal with them as a community.
Right. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Gordon Bonnieman. He's an attorney with the Tennessee Justice Center, former Families USA board member. We're in Washington, D.C. for the Families USA Healthcare Conference. You know, earlier, you know, we talked about, you know, what would have happened had Obamacare failed? And there was a very real possibility that, you know, because, you know, Max Boxman, you know, not one of my favorite guys, seemed to, you know, not go in the right direction in my view. What if this would have failed, like the Clinton initiative back in the 90s? What do you think would have happened with that?
Oh, I think this issue would have been politically radioactive, and nobody would have touched it for at least 30 years, probably more, and more people would have become uninsured, more people would have found it unaffordable, more people would have been ruined financially, and more people would die because of delays and inadequate care. And, I don't know if you saw the movie Lincoln, but you realize how close it was that we got the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery. I'm from the state that took women's suffrage over the line to make it law. It was won by one vote. I think most major steps forward in our country's history are very closely run things. This is a very closely run thing. The status quo doesn't yield to reform easily. And I think the fact that this has been so controversial is just part of what it takes to move forward.
Do you think part of the problem with this, and a lot of the folks that I've talked to about, it's the long implementation. You know, 2014, when it was passed, seemed like forever away, and most people were just focused on the negative and the distortions that they were hearing.
Right.
Do you think that if they would have implemented it maybe a little sooner, or could they have implemented it sooner?
I don't think they could have. I mean, I think, again, the stories this time next year are going to be some of these exchanges have bumps, people are running into glitches. It's a very tight time frame, actually. If you look at what it involves in making significant changes to a very large, complex, and uncoordinated system and trying to impose some kind of coordination on that. I've been working, for example, with a lot of colleagues in other parts of the country that have a lot of experience trying to access insurance for people on how you design an online application for insurance that deals with all of the different bells and whistles of private insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, children's health insurance. It's very complicated. And just making that work and setting up the computer systems to make that work behind the interface that people are going to encounter is a big project.
A Herculean task, sure.
It is.
One of the things one of my problems is, you know, you're looking at the states who, you know, are going to set up their own plans and their own private plans. I mean, this isn't a government takeover of healthcare by any stretch of the imagination. And it's the states that are going to be doing this. And I come from a state where our governor was one of the lead plaintiffs against it. He's going to be in charge of implementing something he's dead set against. And fortunately, our governor said he's not going to do it. He's going to let the federal government do it. I think that's a good thing for Pennsylvanians. I'm wondering how Tennessee is going to fare in this.
Well, I mean, our state, too, has said we're going to leave it to the feds. There are 30 states that either have Republican governors or Republican legislators. And one of the ironies is this is a federal takeover. It's not. It's left up to the states, and it's ironic.
Well, it's not a federal takeover.
Well,
if you go ahead, take it.
It's ironic that some of my friends in Tennessee who are dead set against it say they hate it because it's a federal takeover. And by the way, we won't cooperate because we want the feds to run it.
And what happened to the 10th Amendment? I mean, you have all these tenthers who go, oh, it's a federal takeover. I go, well, then take it and make it right.
Well, as we say in Tennessee, bless their hearts. You know, they're doing the best they can, and they clearly are not very grounded, I think, in some realities for ordinary people who see the current system is not working. They don't care whose name is on it, who does it. They just need some real solutions to real-life, ordinary household problems, and health care is at the top of that list for so many working families.
What do you say to the argument that, and I've had this come up to me a number of times, that we don't really have any uninsured. Everyone has access to health care because you can always just go to the emergency room.
Well, my little public interest law firm, we serve families from across Tennessee who either are uninsured or many of them have insurance and they met lifetime limits and run up against that or run up against pre-existing conditions. We're dealing with the underbelly of this healthcare system every week. And every week we get together, we've got paralegals, lawyers, we sit around, we troubleshoot. And back 2 years ago when the Tea Party people were turning out and raging against health care, I thought, you know, those folks are decent Americans. They don't get it. If they could come sit in on our case review and just listen to the realities that we deal with, our clients deal with, again, from every background, not just poor, but middle class, working families, and what's happening to them, you know, this argument would go away because it's not grounded in fact. It's grounded in myth.
In fear.
It's grounded in wild, politically driven beliefs. And I'm not claiming that people are insincere, but I am saying it's not grounded in the realities of ordinary people's lives.
Yeah, I always say that, you know, they want to keep us at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, down there at the
right.
at the fear for shelter and the fear level.
Well, there's no greater fear than being a parent of a child who's sick and you can't get them care.
Oh.
That is the worst place to be in the world.
There's a woman, a listener in our area, both of her daughters had cancer at the very same time, and they went through bankruptcy. And it was just an absolute horror story. Last question I've got for you. You know, one of the arguments that that the president has made is you'll be able to keep your insurance the way you have it. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think it is. In fact, I think if a state does not reform its Medicaid to extend to working families that are now excluded and they're low wage, then the workers that have group coverage in that family are going to in that state are going to continue to see their premiums rise because of the shifting of costs. If we implement this, it will begin to contain the cost rise that threatens everybody's coverage right now.
Yeah, to me, it's getting everyone insured is a step in the right direction because we used to understand that prevention thing. There was a guy who flew a kite a long time ago, created the post office, had something about an ounce of prevention, pound to cure kind of thing. You
right.
may remember it.
I do.
Just a thought. Gordon, it was great talking with you. I appreciate
Thank
the
you.
Time. Gordon Bonnieman, attorney at the Tennessee Justice Center. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Wall Streeters are all a Twitter about the comeuppance of Jamie Dimon, the haughty CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. Last year, poor Jamie presided over a $6 billion loss by the bank's chief investment office, so he's now had his own pay cut in half, knocking him down to $11.5 million. I suppose that's really a come-downance, but by whatever name, having his paycheck whacked by J.P. Morgan's board of directors is widely viewed on Wall Street as a harsh rap on the knuckles. But ask about the board's actions? Dimon himself merely said, "I respect their decision." Of course he does. He walked away with his job intact, an $11.5 million wad in his pocket, and a sly grin on his face. Indeed, many investors and bank regulators, not to mention us commoners, don't consider that level of, quote, punishment to be much of a deterrent to the kind of executive narcissism and carelessness that characterizes today's Wall Street elite. Yet, members of the bank's board are actually puffing out their chests, claiming to be bold bank directors. The vote to cut Dimon's pay, they say, shows that by gollies we're an effective take-charge watchdog over the top management of the nation's biggest bank. That they can even say something so absurd speaks volumes about the laissez-faire myth that corporations don't need government regulation since they have private boards that oversee them. Who are J.P. Morgan's directors? Lee Raymond, for one. In fact, he heads the board's compensation committee and took the lead in giving Diamond his haircut. But Raymond is congenitally gentle on CEO pay because he was a lavishly well-paid corporate chieftain himself. As CEO for ExxonMobil for 13 years, his paycheck totaled $686 million, $144,000 a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, corporate governance is a joke. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson
the
hard way.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. So I'm enjoying the our representative Daryl Metcalf's statement about workers' rights. You know, all of our problems, if it's employee health care costs, it's pensions, it's liquor privatization, because we're going to be the liquor state very soon. Everything comes back in Daryl Metcalf's mind in taking workers' rights away and, well, destroying collective bargaining rights. Kind of tells you where the right is on most of these issues. We are here in Washington, D.C., the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I'm sitting here with Senator Debbie Stabenow from Michigan. Senator, thanks for taking time for me.
Absolutely, Rick. Great to be here.
What do you think of the conference? It's been several years in the running, you know, pushing for healthcare for everyone. I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, Families USA is a great advocacy group, and they've made a real difference. This is very important, what is both implemented now. We've got about 3 million young people that wouldn't have insurance right now who are under age 26 if it hadn't been for the Affordable Care Act. And I can tell you, as a woman, we've got millions of women that are now getting preventative health care with no copays, including 700,000 in Michigan because of the Affordable Care Act. More to come. Is it everything I would like? No, this is a huge step forward, though,
right.
And we've got to keep building on it. And it really is important, I think, for us as the great country that we are to very simply understand the value statement that health care should be a right, not a privilege. And if you start from there, then you build from there.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of rights that I think working families should have. The right of collective bargaining. I know
Absolutely.
In your state of Michigan, your governor's gone after that, much like I assume our governor is going to, all of that push is going forward. And I look at health insurance as another one of those worker issues. You cannot possibly be in the middle class in this country without that kind of security.
Absolutely. And, you know, Michigan, we like to say we created the middle class because of Henry Ford and automobiles. And he had a very simple philosophy that really built the middle class for us, which is you ought to pay a fair wage. He was paying folks, $5 a day when you didn't have to do that. And everybody said to him, well, you're crazy. Why are you doing that? And he said, I need somebody who can afford to buy my automobiles.
Not because he was benevolent.
No, it was economics.
Exactly.
You know, and that's what folks don't understand. They think by attacking, whether it's right to work or collective bargaining or whatever, that somehow they make us more competitive. It makes us less competitive when we don't have a solid middle class, people with money in their pockets who can afford to buy things.
Absolutely. And I look at this health care reform as jobs. What we
no
need
question.
Desperately in this country. Jobs plans. If it's infrastructure, if it's health care, if it's education, that's what we need now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know what? As much as we are in a deficit hole, and we are because of two wars unfunded and a whole bunch of other things that happened, the fact is we're never going to get out of debt with 12 million people out of work. So we better be focused on jobs and growing the economy.
Yeah, but, you know, my problem is now you look to Congress, we can't seem to get a simple transportation bill passed out. And this health care thing, while as divisive it is, it's done. It's the law. But yet I still see, the repeal bills, and I know that the support is dwindling. But we need to be moving forward. Enough of this part of this bickering.
No
Move
question.
The country forward.
No question. I mean, we did pass a two-year transportation bill. The Affordable Care Act did get passed. We're in this ideological fight. Unfortunately, I believe that traditional Republican Party has been taken hostage by very extreme elements who really just want to shut everything down.
Yeah.
And don't believe in our democracy, don't believe in the public sector as a role, as part of our country in a strong democracy. And it makes everything twice as hard as it should be, slower than it should be. The good news is that this president won despite all of that, and I think a very big message was sent that people want to continue moving forward. And they want us to work together.
Yeah.
This really does require people stepping up and getting beyond their narrow self-interest and doing what's best for the country.
Yeah, you know, I look at our you brought up extreme ideologues, and our representative, Daryl Metcalf, who believes taking union rights away from people is the way to move the country forward. And one of my first hopes for the president back in 2009 was that he would be the guy who saved the reward of work in this country. And I don't see that being the case. Just a report out yesterday said 43% of the nation is, you know, a couple of paychecks away from being in the streets. Are we going to see any serious labor law reform at some point? Because we're seeing states like Michigan, we're seeing Wisconsin,
right.
We're seeing Indiana, all of this attacks on workers' rights. Are we going to see that, something on the federal level?
Well, we would like to make sure that we are providing, you know, strong, accountable laws. We, right now, get blocked in the House of Representatives every step of the way. But the president on his own, through his appointments to the National Labor Relations Board, has been able to make a difference. I mean, he has put forward people for confirmation. The Senate Democrats have confirmed them. The Republicans now have then gone to court to try to stop things that the NLRB is doing. But
right.
The president, within his power of appointment, is trying to move things forward.
Well, I hope that's the case, and I hope as we move forward we will see more jobs coming out of this, because that's the way forward.
Absolutely.
It's very simple.
Amen.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Senator Debbie Stabenow. You know, I look at this and I go back to the reality. You know, all of the divisiveness at home, all of the Daryl Metcalfs and all of the Corbett privatization schemes pushing us towards the liquor economy and the gambling economy, it does. It really comes back down to the jobs, bottom line, simple stuff. And the Metcalf mentality, this idea that we can take bargaining rights away and understand why. You know, Zach Wamp was pretty honest about it. You know, in Tennessee, which is a right-to-work state, lower wages, less benefits, pretty simple stuff. The direction that the right, the extreme right, wants to take us. Down. Sell off our assets. Stop and think about the privatization scheme that he's come up with. There are 5,000 people who have good-paying, middle-class jobs with family-sustaining wages, family-secure benefits, health care, some retirement. Those are going to be eviscerated. Done. Gone. Buy. Not. Over. Liquor will then become an impulse item. It will become another item on the shelf at the Walmart or at the grocery store or at the 7-Eleven or the corner market. It's going to end up being. It's not going to be the family-sustaining jobs that we have, the tax-paying jobs that we have right now that we need more of to get us out of this economic mess that we're in. And where Metcalf believes stealing collective bargaining rights away, destroying unionization, where he thinks that that's the way forward, I'm telling you the way forward is pretty simple. We need to be expanding opportunities for the working poor. We need to be expanding opportunities for working people through collective bargaining. And for me, you know, you come to this healthcare law. I've always been a supporter of collective bargaining. I believe healthcare is one of those things you bargain for at the table if we're hell-bent on continuing a employer-based system. Problem is you've got too many of the Metcalfs running around. You've got too many of the right wing saying, well, you know what, we need to destroy that. We need to destroy that right of collective bargaining. And we need to get people to work for less wages, people who are willing to take lower benefits, people who are willing to put their family at greater risk. It's pretty simple stuff to me. And I go back again, you know, while these states may be doing this, I'm in favor of going back and repealing Taft-Hartley. Get rid of all of this right-to-work nonsense. You should have the right to collective bargaining. Simple. But there are those who, well, not so much. And you go back and you look at throughout the years. You go back and you look at my grandparents' generation, who they weren't. My grandparents weren't a week or 2 weeks away from homelessness. They had a nest egg. They had savings. I look at this, almost half of the nation on the edge of financial collapse, no savings. What does that say? It says we've got work to do. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We are here at the Families USA Healthcare Conference. Going to take a quick break right back from Washington, D.C. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You know they're going to push us around. Mr. Theft and Digging, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, because I'm going to leave it in the ground. Mr. Theft and Digging, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. He's going to take a line along at an 80 short date for this miner to cool on down. This half can dig it, Mr. Harley can haul it, because I'm going to leave it in the ground.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, spider brains. The brains of tiny spiders are so large, they fill their body cavities and overflow into their legs.
Researchers at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama measure the central nervous systems of 9 species of spiders, from rainforest giants to spiders smaller than the head of a pin. As the spiders get smaller, their brains get proportionally bigger, filling up more and more of their body cavities.
The researchers said that the smaller the animal, the more it has to invest in its brain power in order to be able to perform fairly complex behaviors, like, in the case of spiders, weaving a web.
They discovered that the central nervous systems of the smallest spiders fill up almost 80% of their total body cavity, including about 25% of their legs.
Some of the tiniest immature baby spiders even have deformed, bulging bodies. That bulge contains excess brain. Adults of the same species don't bulge.
Brain cells use a lot of energy, so small spiders probably convert much of the food they consume into brain power. I'm Jorge Salazar.
I'm Deborah Bird. For more on this story, come to EarthSky.org and search on the words spider brains. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. Fuzzy math. I'm practicing fuzzy math. A lot of times we need to fudge the numbers and not tell the truth. For diplomacy to be effective, lies must be credible.
I miss him. I really do. He made even the most dull person a comedian. That was radio gold right there. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So we saw the story, talked about it a couple of days ago, about Papa John. I always love a guy who lives in a massive palatial estate made off the backs of low-wage workers, telling me, well, we can't afford to give those people health care, you know, the people who created the wealth that surrounds me. because it raised the price of a pizza a whopping 11 cents. Well, it turns out that's not even true either. In fact, the numbers that he used, didn't really use any, just like most instant facts, reached around behind and popped out a good number, like most facts. But here to talk about some actual facts, I've got Kim Bailey, Director of Research for the good folks here at Families USA. Kim, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure. Good morning.
So I look at Papa John, and you look at this number, 11 cents per pizza, and, which I don't even think is outrageous. I mean, I would happily pay 11 cents for every one of those people to have the health security they think every person in this country should have. And then we find out that that's not even true.
It's unfortunate that one can use facts or use numbers inappropriately and claim that they are facts when they, in fact, are not.
I guess it's like most, you know, like most statistics or facts are 99% of facts are made up on the spot.
I don't know if 99%, but you can use numbers to tell a story that may or may not be, in fact, true.
So let's talk about the Obamacare, which, you know, right when it passed, I think I was one of the very first people who said, we should embrace this. There should be Obamacare T-shirts. You should wear it like a badge of honor. And now we've kind of come around to that, and people are now in a positive way calling it Obamacare, which I think is a huge step forward. But what are the numbers? I mean, how many people are we going to be able to get insured?
Well, we're going to cover at least 30 million people.
And how many do we have that are uninsured? Somewhere 50 million, right?
Around 50 million. Around 50 million. But I think, you know, what we should talk about in the context of the Papa John story is how important having workers covered is for the economy.
Absolutely.
If you have people who are uninsured working for you, you'll have people who are delaying care, forgoing care. You're going to have people who are sicker and aren't as productive on the job. So really, I would argue that if you give people good, high-quality coverage, they'll be healthier, they'll be happier, they'll be better workers.
That's if you care about the workers. I mean, that's if you care. If you have a high-turnover industry like that is, like a lot of the low-wage industries, you just churn through people. I mean, you're in and out of this. There's a constant flow because of the low wages to begin with, and then you add on top of it the no health care because they're used to that high turnover, high churn rate.
Perhaps you could change the system and make them healthier, happier, and stay longer on the job.
Which most of us would think would be the way to build a business, but you know, I look at the estate that Mr. John there lives in, made off the backs of those workers. You go, he's done pretty well for himself by extracting.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
So the question for me then becomes is why do I want someone like him in charge of health care for people who are making that wealth? And why do I want an employer-based system?
It's a great question. I think one thing we do with the Affordable Care Act is start to build a system that gives the American people more options and gives Americans choices so that they're not necessarily locked into jobs they don't want to have. I mean, I think what we see now is that people may stay in jobs because of the health insurance coverage that those jobs provide.
I know a lot of people like that.
And people that feel that they can't go out and start a business on their own because they're afraid to lose their health insurance benefits. I think it really stifles our economy.
So there's going to be a measure of portability, is what you're saying?
Exactly. And so if someone wants to go out and start a small business on their own, insurance company can't deny them. Right now, with our system where insurers are, you know, at their whim to deny people coverage, it means that people don't necessarily strike out on their own and start a small business or decide to be self-employed when they otherwise could be.
Are there any examples of where that's actually happened? I know it's a nice talking point, and I've used it myself, the entrepreneurial spirit. I know that, you know, as a small business owner myself, you know, that moving from a job that had health insurance to something else, well, you know, it's a huge leap. And I know a lot of people like that, but do you have any actual, being a director of research, are there any factual, anything to back that up?
There are actually a number of studies out there that show that people do indeed remain locked in their jobs. There's estimates that about 25% of job mobility is limited because of health insurance coverage. And there's actually a lot of literature that shows, too, that people stay in jobs not only because of themselves, but also because of family members. So if you have a chronically ill family member or a child with a pre-existing health condition, you're more likely to stay in a job to give that family member coverage.
Yeah, and it pops into my head again. I've got a few friends who, through the years, that's happened to. In fact, I have a few friends who they have actually reached the cap of their health insurance, which, as I understand, Obamacare does away with.
That's right. That's right. There will no longer be annual or lifetime limits allowed in plans, which is incredibly important because if you have a condition like hemophilia, it's a condition you can go through an annual cap within a few months,
wow.
And then a family is left out in the cold.
Yeah, I remember my friend, his wife had a heart attack and his kid had leukemia, and at the end of a year and a half, they had gone to the $1 million cap, mm-hmm. And then it was like, well, where do you go from here? Because now you can't go get insurance anywhere else.
Yep. You're stuck.
And, you know, I'm assuming as a person who does this research that there are a lot of people just like that.
There are many, many people just like that. There are, you know, estimates suggest that about a third of Americans have a pre-existing condition. The vast majority of us actually still have employer-based coverage. But a lot of people are afraid to leave it, or if they end up in a job that provides coverage that's not as good, they may have to seek another job that may not be as good of a fit to get better coverage.
So in looking at the numbers, and you go, you know, immediately 2014, because there's going to be a period of which, you know, the adjustment, the implementation, all of that, you're looking at 32 million eventually. What about the rest of the people? Is there a plan to, is there something to get everyone else into this as well? Because for me, the whole idea is everybody should be covered, and this way the price costs should come down, right?
Yeah, there is definitely literature out there. Families USA, in fact, did a study with the military. That looks at the cost shift. So when we have people who are uninsured in the system, they still need care, and they do as much as they can to pay for that care, but there's still a cost. They can't pay for it in whole.
But we have national health care, I'm told. I listen to a lot of right-wing pundits say, you know, if you're sick, you go to the doctor.
They are wrong.
Pretty simple.
They are wrong.
Go to the emergency. George Bush himself, go to the emergency
you
room.
You go to the emergency room, but that puts you at risk for having it on your credit record for the rest of your life. It can financially ruin people. And even if they, you know, that's if they're able to pay some.
Then you just pay $1 a week for the rest of your life, and then you're fine.
No, unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. It bankrupts families.
But, you know, I hear it all the time. That my right-wing friends say all the time, if I get sick, because I don't have health insurance, if I get sick, I'll just go to the doctor. They have to take care of me. It's the law. And I'll just pay them $1 a week.
Unfortunately, there is a lot of evidence out there that shows that that just doesn't work.
Doesn't
people
work.
End up bankrupt. Yeah. About two-thirds of bankruptcies are due at least in part to medical causes.
Yeah, but listen, you know, I look at a lot of the distortions. This is not a government takeover?
No.
I was kind of hoping for a government takeover so that my friends would have something really to complain about.
No, it's all private, based in the private system.
Yeah. Is that a good thing?
It's a mixed bag. It's an American thing.
Okay. Because, you know, you look at all the death panels, because I'm trying to get someone, if they're the death panels, I'm trying to get someone to put me on. There's some folks I'd like to get rid of.
Yeah, death panels just don't
not
exist.
Happening?
Not in the law.
How about the contraception thing? Government intruding on religion, making them provide contraception for you women folk? Nothing?
Well, many would argue that contraception is a very good thing to allow family planning.
Oh, I'm in favor of it. In fact, there's a college in our listening area that has actually a vending machine for Plan B.
Interesting.
And evidently, the FDA said they're allowed to do it, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, increases access to it, very important.
But, you know, I wish Obamacare would do more in that thing. So as you're looking at this, and the last question I've got for you, because I'm all about the costs. You know, we are now paying more for health care than anyone in the world by any measure that you can come up with. Is this going to bring us in line with the rest of the world, or are we still going to remain double but just not go triple?
There's a lot in the Affordable Care Act that is focused on changing the way the healthcare system works. And our system is fundamentally broken right now. We have a lot of the wrong incentives that are really driving costs up. So one of the great things that's built into the Affordable Care Act is testing of a lot of new payment models, changing the way that we pay doctors, changing the way that we pay hospitals, and really trying to change the incentives so that there aren't incentives within the system to just do more, 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 more.
To churn stuff out.
That's not necessarily effective and can, in fact, be harmful.
But don't you think all of this has to do with a change in our culture? Not just how we pay doctors, but, you know, the food that we process, a lot of the chemicals that are allowed to be spewed into our environment, some of our personal behaviors, isn't that all part of it?
It's all part of it, but I think you can't fully explain the difference in amount of spending in the U.S. system versus other systems with those factors alone.
Right, okay. Well, I appreciate the time, Kim. It was great talking with you. It was always great to be here at the Families USA Conference. Kim Bailey, Director of Research for Families USA. Quick break, right back from Washington, D.C. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
together. The Rick Smith Show. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The education battle in Seattle over standardized measures of academic performance, or MAP, tests is escalating, with the Seattle School District threatening 10-day suspensions for teachers unless they administer the tests by February 22nd. Both the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers are supporting the Seattle teachers in their uprising against the MAP tests. NEA President Dennis Van Roekel says it's a defining moment within the education profession as teachers take a stand against what the NEA calls flawed tests not aligned with school curriculums that aren't good for students or teachers. Chris McBride is academic dean at Seattle's Garfield High School.
With me today are just some of the teachers who have decided to take a really strong stand against what we all know is an unnecessary expense and a drain on our very few and precious resources. More importantly, however, our students are not benefiting from this test. In fact, it's hurting many of our students in our most fragile populations, as well as those kids who need more class time, not less class time.
Jesse Agapian is a teacher at Garfield.
We have a different destination here. Teachers at Garfield and schools across Seattle have a different destination for their kids, and that destination is not on the map. Our destination is a destination of creativity. Our destination is a destination of critical thinking. We want to teach our kids to solve real problems that they see in the community. And our stand against this MAP test is teaching them that.
Hundreds of United Mine Workers of America members and their supporters rallied this week at Peabody Energy headquarters in St. Louis to protest a long-term scheme to strip critical health benefits away from miners, retirees, and their families. UMWA President Cecil Roberts was arrested in the protests. The union says Patriot Coal's bankruptcy case in federal court is being used to take away the hard-earned health benefits of thousands of miners. Patriot was spun off from Peabody. Roberts says this is a sickening display of corporate greed that has overstepped the bounds of decency. He says UMWA will continue to fight so active and retired miners don't have to lay awake at night wondering if they can survive the next week, month, or year without health benefits.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Look, we know in days like yesterday and today we have a lot of work to do. We got to make sure that we work with our counterparties, our clients, to get the answers they want, and we're pursuing that as we speak. And we're also exploring other alternatives, such as strategic investments or investors and other financing alternatives. So we have work to do, and we're doing it right now.
What exactly does that mean?
It means I think you're an adult, and I'm just going to say a lot of words and hope you don't realize that I didn't actually say anything. These are the people who are in control of your health care. Wow, good point. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. We are here in Washington, D.C. at the Hyatt Regency Hotel here at Capitol Hill, the nation's capital. For the Families USA Healthcare Conference. You look at a new report just out by the CDC that points out that, you look at the flu numbers that are all of the epidemic and all of the stuff going on, the number of people who are getting their flu shots. According to the CDC, there are an unacceptably low number of people who are getting them. And again, you go and you look at it by who has the wealth to be able to do it. First and foremost, if you can't afford to go and get it, and I know that they're cheap, but, or they're relatively inexpensive. But if you're living on the margin, if you're one of the nearly half of the people who's a couple of weeks away from being in serious financial trouble, it's an expense to pay. I can't afford it. And to me, it's one of those things that where you go, and it's not a lot of things that we do. We short the low cost constant stuff, the preventative stuff, and hope. And I guess that's you know, part of being in the middle class right now, or being near the middle class, is that wish and hope. I wish I was well, and I hope I don't get sick. And the prevention is what suffers. And for me, you know, when I look at this healthcare law, I say, you know, it's the prevention that I want to see more of. I want to see people going to the doctor more often. And I remember when the whole argument was going on, people were saying, well, people are going to go to the doctor. And I'm like, well, that's a good thing. Isn't it? When you have constant treatment of diabetes, when you have constant care, people start, you know, paying attention to, you know, my high blood pressure, you know, the sugar levels, weight, all of that stuff. The other things come down. The big, you know, it's kind of like to use a car analogy. You change your oil occasionally. Guess what? Engine's probably not going to blow up. You put air in your tires. You're probably not going to wear them out as quickly. Basic preventative maintenance, if you will. And, you know, it seems very clear to me. Very, very clear to me. And you know what I find interesting? You know, yesterday the governor had his, you know, it's all about choice conference, you know, because we need to have choice of liquor. We need that because we're, I guess, now living in the liquor economy. It's about choice, yet choice not being in the healthcare world. And I know the right has done a masterful job of pushing this idea that, well, you know, it's a government takeover and you're not going to have choice. And what I'm hearing from people, what I'm hearing from the experts, the people who actually work on this stuff and know about it, not people who have just made stuff up, reached behind, pulled out some idea, people who actually worked on the implementation, this is about choice. I mean, you're going to have a whole litany of, I heard it advertised as the travelocity of healthcare. I don't know that I'm all that thrilled with, but, you know, at the end of the day, there will be some choice. Yet we've got a governor who wants choice for liquor, but no choice for health care. And I would argue that making us the liquor state, I think, would have some externality, some additional health care problems. Just a thought. Anyway, breaking down the myth of the makers and the takers, because, you know, in the healthcare angle, well, you know, those people. And I always love that. I always love the finger pointing and the those people angle. I think, because those are the takers. Those are the, those are the parasites. I still remember the guy with the big 48-foot trailer out, I think it was Missouri, with the big trailer that said, are you a producer or a parasite? And Democrats are parasites, and a whole nine yards. And it turns out he was taking massive government subsidies. Again, that line between the maker and taker, a little blurred. Just like this new study from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. And it tells exactly what we've always known. The lower your income, the higher percentage of state tax you pay. Pennsylvania being one of the top states where that happens. And the study is titled, Who Pays? A Distributional Analysis of the Tax System in All 50 States. And in Pennsylvania, it's pretty simple. People in the lowest 20% of the economy, they pay about 12% of their income in local and state taxes. And as you go, you know, up the socioeconomic ladder, that number goes down. The second 20% pays 10.4. The middle 20 pays just over 10. By the time you get to the top, to that top 1%, they're paying 4.4%. And, you know, there's the argument then there that some of the flat taxers would make, well, everybody should pay the flat tax. And I go, well, I'm on the state tax, I can almost make that argument. But shouldn't it be flipped around just a little bit? And I was walking through the mall last night. As you know, I took my daughter to get glasses, because again, you know, my healthcare plan only pays for glasses for a child once every 2 years. And anybody who has kids knows their eyes change more often than that. So we're at the mall trying to pick out a pair of glasses that cost me a small fortune. And you know, I overhear this couple arguing about Phil Mickelson, and her going into the whole talking part. Do you believe they're going to take 63% of his paycheck? And the guy's like, no, they're not. And he was trying to explain it in a very rational way. And I guess that's, you know, when you talk about any issue, you've got the two groups. You've got people who are in the fact-based, rational argument camp, and then you've got the people who just, they have an ideology to start with. And that ideology is anti-government. That ideology is always going to be reactionary. Instead of listening to the fact that this guy was trying to explain, here's what the federal is, here's what the state is, here's what their local is, but here are all the loopholes that come in. She wanted none of it. And even just a pure math of what he laid out was nowhere near 63%. Again, nowhere, wanted to hear none of it. And I would argue from the other side of this, going, fine, well, what if it were 63%? Is that a bad thing? Because that money would then go into the local economy, it would go into infrastructure, it would go into education, it would go into healthcare, and everyone would do better, including the person paying the higher rate. Because understand, we used to have an extraordinarily high rate. 92% was a very high rate. And guess what? We still had rich people. And a good number of them. The difference was is they used the money, and which is why I've always said I'm very pro-loophole. I'm pro-incentive, because then they use that money locally. And if you want to slap their name on the side of a hospital, I'm okay with that, as long as the community benefits from the hospital. Now what we've got is we've got people going, well, I'm going to hoard, and I'm going to invest overseas, and I'm going to do all of these things that not building the community. And you wonder why you go to places where there's only one hospital servicing an entire area. And I looked at the story from North Dakota where they're having a gas boom. And I understand we're having the same problems in the northern tier in Pennsylvania. As you have this influx of people coming in, the local infrastructure is taxed, is overextended. And that money, that wealth that's being pulled from the ground is leaving. It's not expanding. It's not expanding the local area. It's not helping the local area whatsoever. It is, however, creating some fairly very wealthy people. But some of the key findings from Pennsylvania, at least, Pennsylvania families earning less than $19,000, the poorest fifth, pay 12%. As you go up, you folks, when you figure out where you're at, the 36 to 58,000 pay 10.1%. People with the incomes over $1 million, that richest 1%, 4.4%. They point out that Washington, Florida, South Dakota, Illinois, Texas, Tennessee, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Indiana, and Alabama are among the 10 most regressive tax states in the nation, Pennsylvania ranking 8th. Four of the states have no personal income tax. One state applies it only to interest and dividends, and the other five, including Pennsylvania, have a personal income tax that is flat or virtually flat across all income groups. And, you know, you look at this and you go, well, if it's a flat tax, you know, how is it that they pay so much of their income? Well, again, you go back to a lot of the loopholes, a lot of the things that we give away. And for me, it's completely upside down. I would argue it should be the other way around. But here again, you know, it's those people in Harrisburg who have made this. It's those politicians who say, oh, well, you know, we can't cut taxes. We can't raise taxes. We can't invest in education because, you know, taxes are too high already. And I look at this graph. I look at this study. I'm sorry. For you and me, and you're right. For the very wealthy who've done very well, not so much. You know, as I've said from the beginning of the whole Tea Party thing, I agreed with their little moniker. I think working people are taxed enough already. Pretty simple. Pretty simple concept. And who did that? It's the people we keep electing. It's the people we keep putting into power, the Daryl Metcalfs of the world, the Terzis, the Corbetts. And what do we get in return? Well, we get our assets sold off. We get an attack on workers' rights. We get an attack on pensions. We get an attack on education, you name it. Write down the entire No Rights at Work agenda. And I'm hoping at some point we say there's enough. There's only so much of you know what I'm willing to eat, and we need to push back, which is why we have term limits. And I know my conservative friends are, we don't have term limits. Yeah, we do. It's called the right to vote. And look at what they're doing. Do you really want a liquor economy? Do you want a gambling economy? Do we fund education and do we fund programs for seniors through vice spending? What does that say about us? Yeah, we take hard money, hard tax money out of the budget and hand off to corporations in the hopes that maybe they'll create a job. And, you know, as the one thing said, wish in one hand and, you know, in the other hand. See which one fills up first. Because wishing and hoping, not working. Liquor economy, not going to work. But ideology, that's the bottom line. Going to take a quick break. Right back from Washington, D.C., the Families USA Healthcare Conference. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
That's one place I won't be. I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Wall Streeters are all a-Twitter about the comeuppance of Jamie Dimon, the haughty CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. Last year, poor Jamie presided over a $6 billion loss by the bank's chief investment office, so he's now had his own pay cut in half, knocking him down to $11.5 million. I suppose that's really a come-downance. But by whatever name, having his paycheck whacked by J.P. Morgan's board of directors is widely viewed on Wall Street as a harsh rap on the knuckles. But ask about the board's actions? Dimon himself merely said, "I respect their decision." Of course he does. He walked away with his job intact, an $11.5 million wad in his pocket, and a sly grin on his face. Indeed, many investors and bank regulators, not to mention us commoners, don't consider that level of, quote, punishment to be much of a deterrent to the kind of executive narcissism and carelessness that characterizes today's Wall Street elite. Yet, members of the bank's board are actually puffing out their chests, claiming to be bold bank directors. The vote to cut Dimon's pay, they say, shows that by gollies we're an effective take-charge watchdog over the top management of the nation's biggest bank. That they can even say something so absurd speaks volumes about the laissez-faire myth that corporations don't need government regulation since they have private boards that oversee them. Who are J.P. Morgan's directors? Lee Raymond, for one. In fact, he heads the board's compensation committee and took the lead in giving Dimon his haircut. But Raymond is congenitally gentle on CEO pay because he was a lavishly well-paid corporate chieftain himself. As CEO for ExxonMobil for 13 years, his paycheck totaled $686 million, $144,000 a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, corporate governance is a joke.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
I'm a innocent bystander. Somehow I got stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I'm down on
website, thericksmithshow.com. We're here in Washington, D.C. for the Families USA Healthcare Conference. Our quote of the day comes from Senator Al Franken, a Democratic senator from Minnesota, talking about at the gun hearing yesterday, you know, about the mental illness part of this. He said, you know, I want to be careful here. He said that we don't stigmatize mental illness. The vast majority of people with mental illness are no more violent than the rest of the population. He said, in fact, they're more likely to be the victims of violence. And he's absolutely right. There's been a lot of finger pointing, a lot of that going on, and I worry that we're heading down the wrong path. And you look at a lot of this stuff, no matter what the issue is, a lot of the distortions, a lot of the pushback. You know, I think back to Obamacare, you know, the death panels and the government takeover, which we now know kind of nonsensical. But it's that pushing back against that stuff, which is why we come to these conferences and we talk to the experts in the field, which is why I've got Dr. Tim Jost, professor at the Washington and Lee School of Law. Dr. Jost, thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
You know, when you hear about Obamacare, and right from the beginning, I took on the Obamacare moniker right from the start, saying, look, this is something they should be proud of. Put it out there. Don't run from it. But right from the beginning, it was the distortions about this is a government takeover, there will be death panels. You've heard all of the things. And looking back on it, you know, how could we have handled that better from a messaging point, do you think?
Well, I think that it was going to be a very hard battle from the beginning, because I think that the conservative opposition decided that this is the way they were going to make President Obama a one-term president. And so I am still a little uncomfortable with Obamacare, because it really was an effort of a lot of people, a lot of consumers, a lot of Democrats in Congress, the Senate, and the House, as well as President Obama, who I think pushed it over the finish line. But again, the death panels, the microchips that were going to be planted in people's brains, the taxes that were going to be imposed on every sale of real estate. I mean, there are so many lies out there, and they're still out there. You could find any one of them every couple of weeks I get a chain email from somebody with some...
And it's got to be true.
It's got to be true, because it's in the email. And actually... some people have gone to the trouble of quoting specific physicians, or one of the viral emails that is out there has the Blue Cross logo on it. So these things look pretty authentic unless you try to run them down. I think right now one of the biggest battles that we're facing in implementing the Affordable Care Act is, again, another big misinformation campaign. Last year it was, well, the Supreme Court's going to throw it out, or we're going to knock President Obama out, and we'll get some Republican in there who will repeal the thing.
Right.
That's not going to happen. So what you're hearing now, and this is coming from the right, it's coming from insurers, is nobody's going to be able to afford this. Premiums are going to go up 100%. Employers are going to drop health insurance. Employers are going to turn all their full-time employees into part-time employees. Employers are going to refuse to grow above 49%. Employees, so they don't have to provide health insurance, and also there's a big push saying we're not ready for this. I mean, some of them aren't, because they've been dragging their heels.
Right, like our governor.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. But we've got to delay the whole thing, and so I think if anything, pushback is and truth from the media is more important now than it's ever been. They're going to be winners and losers, but. For most people, at least lower and middle income Americans are going to be big winners, and that message still isn't getting out.
Yeah. You know, I look at the study yesterday that, you know, almost half of the nation is, you know, on the brink of, you know, their one catastrophe, one job loss, one illness away from poverty or homelessness. And you go, I don't know how you can exist in this country without having that health security.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you can exist as a society when you have 50 million people who are uninsured while you're spending so much on health care. There's got to be something done.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what the Affordable Care Act tries to do. I have a son who is 24, and he has a serious chronic illness. He is only insured because of the Affordable Care Act, because of the extension
because
of coverage to age 26. Otherwise, he would be uninsured and facing huge medical bills. 2 years from now, he's not going to be on my policy anymore, and it is really important to me that there be something there for him to do other than just be uninsured.
Yeah, and to me, that's one of the main parts of this, you know, that people get, because there were times where I was uninsured. I was unemployed. And those are times where, I mean, things only spiral further down for people.
Right, yeah.
And as a society, what does it say about us? And I know we've heard the Christian nation frame. As a society, what is it about us that would allow anyone in our society to fall through those holes?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I view healthcare like education. It's not something that's just a pure market good.
It well, maybe something. You do, but then, you know, there are people like our governor who doesn't see it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, you see a lot of the right wing in this country who believes education should be a commodity, just like they think healthcare should be a commodity. And if you can't afford it, hey, tough luck, you're on your own.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got I think there are a lot of people who think otherwise. Those are the people who elected President Obama president, and we need to find them. We need to mobilize them. I mean, I think one of the greatest tragedies in this country was the 2010 elections, where Republicans took many, many state houses and were able then to redistrict so that they're going to be pretty much impregnable for the next 10 years. That was a huge missed opportunity for progressives. And
yeah.
We need to make sure we're not there the next time state elections come up.
So let me ask you, Dr. Jost, you know, as you look at the coming months, the implementation process, to me that's the real nuts and bolts of this. It's
absolutely
either going to work or it's not, based on who's implementing it, on what is going to be available, and what people like me see as the payoff from it.
Mm-hmm.
I see the right, I see the right doing what they do.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to stall, they're going to delay the gridlock. And my concern of this is the stall, delay, and the defunding is the death of this, because we've given them so much power.
Yeah. Well, I really don't think that the Obama administration has come this far to abandon this at the last minute. And everyone I talk to in the administration says we're going to be ready. It's going to be a huge lift. And there are certainly going to be glitches. There always are. I mean, even in the private sector, when people try to implement huge new programs, there are glitches, like Boeing's new jet. I think there will be glitches, and that's unfortunate, but that's the way life is. But we need to push ahead with this, and I really think...
And you fix the problem.
I think, you fix the problems, and the administration's going to do that. And I think on January 1st, 2014, millions of Americans are going to wake up and find out that they are now capable of either insured or capable of getting insured.
Research and your understanding of this, how difficult it's going to be for folks to navigate it. Because, you know, I know a lot of people who they're not internet savvy, they're not computer savvy.
Mm-hmm.
They're very worried about, you know, how am I going to navigate this this other system? How difficult, how simple, how is this going to roll out, do you think?
Well, there's several answers to that. The administration last week published proposed forms online and paper that they are going to use for determining eligibility. And they estimated that it would take about a half hour to fill out the online form and 45 minutes to fill out the paper form. But basically, it's going to be far simpler than applying for Medicaid is today. The only real questions are going to be your age, your income, where you live, your family size. I mean, it's going to be things that people know.
Right.
Health isn't relevant. Assets aren't relevant. The other thing is that the hope is that there are going to be lots of people available to help. The statute refers to navigators, who are people, organizations that are going to get contracts to go out into communities and help people sign up. Also, there are provision for states to provide consumer assistance. There's a new category just came out a week or two ago of enrollment counselors that are probably going to focus more on the Medicaid side. And this is all going to be done through online and through phone banks. There are going to be a lot of people out there in churches and community centers and libraries helping people figure out how to sign up. And in Massachusetts, I was on a panel with an expert from Massachusetts a few months ago, and he literally, while we were on stage, on his computer, enrolled in a health plan. I mean, he didn't do the last step of pushing the button.
Right.
But he chose a health plan and did everything necessary. And it took about 3 minutes. So I think for people who are computer savvy, this is going to be very easy. For people who aren't, there's going to be help.
Okay, well, because that's what's important. Because you look at most of the... I guess maybe it's just an assumption of mine, but you look at the lower income workers, people at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, people who are, you wouldn't assume to be computer savvy, and I worry that the navigation would be very difficult for them.
Yeah, well,
or again, me for that. Matter.
Yeah, for old people like me, but my kids would help me. But in any event, there's going to be a lot of help for people. There's going to be a huge push to get people enrolled. And then, of course, there are always agents and brokers, and they will be incentivized to sign people up. That's what they do. And they're going to have lots of opportunities for a lot of new business under the Affordable Care Act. They'll have to go out and find it, but that's what they do.
Well, this will roll out much like Medicare did back in the 60s as well, and we made it much better. And my grandmother and her generation benefit from that to this day. Last question I've got from the legal aspect of this. Last year we were here for the Supreme Court decision. The legal thing's all done now, right?
No.
Nope.
Lots of lawsuits still out there. No, I mean, that's part of the right-wing strategy, and they're going to keep pushing. I mean,
it's not the law of the land, then. There's more lawsuits.
It is the law of the land, but that doesn't stop lawsuits. There are, of course, a lot of lawsuits right now about contraceptive coverage. And those I don't really see as an Affordable Care Act issue so much as a issue of trying to reconcile women's health concerns with religious beliefs. And that's a struggle that we've been engaged in for a half a century or more.
Is that really the question, though? Because I look at it from a different perspective. It shouldn't be a difference between your religion or your employer. It's a worker issue, in my view.
Yeah.
I don't care who you work for. You shouldn't have any say in what my health care is.
Yeah.
If you're the employer, I don't think you should have that say. That should be between me and my doctor and my provider, if you will, not between the company.
I think that's an important perspective that's being missed here. On the other hand, there are employers out there who have self-insured plans so that they're actually writing the check. I think that that's an important perspective, but I think this is something the courts are going to have to sort out, and it's one of the many kinds of disputes that aren't easy in our society.
Right.
The more important lawsuit, Cato, which is a right-wing advocacy group, has libertarian advocacy group, has been going around the country telling states that the statute does not allow the federal exchanges, which we're going to have in most states, to issue premium tax credits. And their argument is based on a rather screwy reading of the statute, but you can read it that way if you really, really try and want to ignore most of it. There's a lawsuit right now pending in Oklahoma, brought by the Attorney General from Oklahoma, that's trying to get the courts to declare that the regulations are invalid and nobody in over half the states will be able to get premium tax credits. That's a very important lawsuit.
That is, because you're going to defund it.
Because you'd be defunding the most important part of the program.
And the thing that gets me is I wish they would spend the kind of effort that they're spending on denying people care. I wish they'd spend that kind of effort in getting people care.
Wouldn't that be nice?
And that's on a plethora of issues as well. Dr. Jim Joyce, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break. Right back from the Families USA Healthcare Conference. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high-interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pfecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So Lindsey Graham yesterday in his grilling of Mark Kelly, and you gotta love this, saying that, well, you know, budgets are gonna be cut, we're not gonna have as many policemen on the streets, so we need more guns. Everybody should have a gun. And I saw this thing, Missouri, they're gonna have first graders and kindergartners taking gun courses. So at some point we're gonna have kids packing heat. That's how we're gonna protect our schools. And we got our governor. A big blanket we want to put around the schools. Big loving arms. The guy who cut $2 billion from public education over the last 2 years. Yeah. And he's going to fund education with liquor. That's a great way, Governor. There you go. Oh, frustrating stuff. We're here in Washington, D.C., the Families USA Healthcare Conference. And you look at this and you go, healthcare, it should already be in the 21st century an absolute right. I hear my Christian friends say we're a Christian nation, but forget about that whole take care of the sick kind of thing that goes on. I'm sitting here with Reverend Cynthia Abrams. She's the Director of Healthcare Programs for the United Methodist Church. Reverend, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure. Glad to be here.
So I hear this frame, and you know, I go to church, I go through all that, I hear the sermons, but I hear the right talk to me about religion a lot. Yet, healthcare, not one of the core tenets that come out of their mouths. I think there's a disconnect between what Christianity is and the practice that we're putting forth. Thought?
Well, I think, we have quite a diversity when we talk about Christianity in our nation, quite a diversity in terms of theologies. And in some of the faith groups, I think it is often not talked about, and it's puzzling to me, actually, because I was just talking to a colleague yesterday about this. We were talking about Christian bookstores, how when you walk into a Christian bookstore and you can find all kinds of material on evangelism, music ministry, speaking in tongues. But when you ask them, where's your section on poverty or where's your section on social issues, usually there might be a tiny little section tucked away somewhere in the back of the bookstore. That's puzzling to me, because if you think about the Bible and what the Bible says about poverty and what it says about taking care of others and what Jesus' ministry is, I think it's pretty clear that it's predominant. So to not talk about it, to not engage it, to not be active in transforming our world, the brokenness in our world, including those that don't have enough health care, is really denying what God's vision is for us to begin with. And so what I do is I challenge others to think about this, to think more seriously about why we want to engage, why we want to be about transforming brokenness where we see it, and where we see others that don't have enough, and do it in a substantive way, a systemic way, not just in a way that may benefit, say, an individual family that's hurting, but rather transform the systems that allow that to be perpetuated.
I'm right there with you. Well, one of the things that I say we absolutely need is I believe collective bargaining, much like health care, should be a civil right. I mean, it should be something that a natural born right. And the ability to earn a decent wage and to have health care and that security, to me, I think is extremely important. And, you know, going back to the Bible, everybody reads the same thing, but it's like we take different things from it.
Right.
I mean, and to me, you know, healing the sick was one of those core tenets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how is it that I see evangelical groups coming out against health care for everybody? It makes no sense to me.
Yes. Well, it's puzzling to me, too, actually.
And the poverty thing. I mean, you know, one of this last election we just had, there was virtually no discussion of poverty, virtually no discussion of the low-wage workers in this country. It was all, how do we make everyone like Mitt Romney?
Right. And I think that they're, you know, ignoring those comprehensive issues that we have in our country, even around the globe in terms of poverty, ignores the symptoms of poverty, such as lack of access to health care, lack of adequate wages or what we call a living wage, a fair wage, a living wage for a family, so that they're able to actually thrive rather than to constantly be struggling. You know, these are all factors in helping to, I think, fulfill the vision that we see in Jesus' ministry, that we see. It's pervasive. It's a pervasive theme throughout the Bible that God wants what's best for God's people. Okay?
All of them.
All of them.
Even those brown ones who
exactly.
Sometimes come across the border.
Right. And Jesus says, I came that you might have life and have it abundantly. He didn't say part of us have life abundantly or only those who
can afford it.
It's everyone, every single person. Everyone, even those that you may disagree with vehemently, we all should have access to it. So anything we do in terms of actions as a Christian, if we're going to live faithfully into that vision, is about acting to make the world look like that. And so as a pastor, as a clergy person myself, when I'm speaking to people in the pews about this, I talk about fulfilling God's vision for what God wants for God's people. I don't lead with a, well, do you like Obamacare?
I really don't. I think it could have been so much more.
Oh, absolutely.
And so much better.
Okay, so it's a step in the right direction.
Absolutely.
That's what I call it. It's a step in the right direction.
We're on the path.
But we're on the path, but we still are on the journey, and we haven't attained where we need to be. And we need to continue to act so that we can get farther down that road. So it is that step. But when we talk about it as Christians, let's talk about it in a language that we understand and from the perspective of what we see is present biblically and theologically. And to me, to living as a faithful Christian means righting what we see as wrongs in the world, changing and helping to be that one of those agents of change that transforms the world so it's a better place after we leave it.
Now, I'm right there with you. And one of the questions that, you know, I brought up to one of my evangelical friends is, you know, do you think Jesus would have been anti-Obamacare? I mean, you know, the guy who went and actually did the healing himself, do you think he'd be anti-Obamacare? And I wonder about that. It's just like I saw a story the other day that Jesus would have been pro-gun. We're going to put guns in the hands of first graders in Missouri, evidently. So the question is Jesus pro-gun, I guess, right?
Well, I mean, that asking those questions, I think, are, well...
And I asked them, in a light way, but you know, there are people who seriously believe this stuff.
Right, they do,
and that's
and
what scares me.
Unfortunate, it is scary because if you read the depth and breadth of Jesus' life and what he stood for and why he came, why God sent what we call the incarnation, why God sent a human being, his son, to show us how we're supposed to live. I mean, that's why he did it. Basically, God, you know, said, here's what I imagine. God's like, they still can't get it straight. So I'm going to have to send somebody to help them, show them so that they can figure it out.
Well, he better send somebody again because we're not figuring it out very
well. That's what we wait for, right? But in the meantime, this is the meantime. In between the time that that happens and now, we have to be those agents of change. In the meantime, we have to be about that. We can't just sit here and wait. Sitting here and doing nothing, that's a recipe for disaster. And it's a recipe for not living into God's vision. It's letting the brokenness exist and doing nothing. That, to me, is sin.
Yep.
Doing nothing when you see someone who is doing without basic needs is a sin.
So, you know, but bringing this to the individual, because, you know, where we have our studio, it's a high poverty area. There are a lot of homeless people who, you know, I put $3 in my pocket every day. The first three people I come across, I give them a dollar.
Right.
An individual cannot possibly solve the problem
That
we've allowed to happen.
That's right.
And, you know, I see this homeless problem, and I go, we've got to, as a society, fix this.
Right.
It's the same thing with health care. It's the same thing. I grew up in a housing project in the west side of Cleveland. I saw all kinds of things no child should ever see.
Right.
We need to be working on all of those things, and it doesn't seem as though we've prioritized that. We've prioritized tax cuts for the very wealthy. We've prioritized handouts for big businesses. But everybody else began.
And that's why it's so important for people of faith to talk to their members of Congress and their elected officials and their county leaders and their city leaders about what the and talking about it from the perspective of a person of faith, how we can transform this and how we might be involved. I mean, we have to be reminding them of the conscience of who we are as you know, as Americans, and the conscience of who we are as God's children. We when they lose sight of that, when they can't see the forest for the trees, we need to be about reminding them and bringing them back to the basics of, you know, at the end of the day, we want to make sure that every person has a bed to lie in, food to eat, and if they are able to work, that they can work at a job that gives them a living wage and that they're able to thrive and achieve. I mean, if you think about it as an evangelism tool, this is a way to talk about when you're talking to a conservative Christian. How can someone feel that they have access to God's love if all they're worrying about is whether or not they're going to have enough food? They can't even begin to think about their own spirituality, their own faith, and their own life unless their basic needs are met. I mean, it's got to be, they're part and parcel. It's one thing. It's not an either or.
Right.
It's not just, oh, I'm going to save you and you're going to, and everything's going to be okay. It's we need to address these issues so that if we want more people to know God's love, we need to demonstrate it. We have to show it.
Good point. Last question I've got for you. As the healthcare, the director of healthcare programs with the United Methodist Church, the healthcare programs for the church, what exactly does that mean?
Well, I actually work on healthcare advocacy, which is public policy. And, you know, the United Methodist Church at our general conference says healthcare is a basic human right.
And I agree.
And so what we do is we educate and resource local churches and annual in our area bodies, as well as individual United Methodists, about the position of the church, why we have it, and exactly what we've been talking about, why it is that we do this as Christians, so that they might act in their own areas and their own settings. In addition, we also let legislators know, particularly United Methodist legislators know, you know, what the church thinks about these things. We like to say that we go not asking, we're an advocacy group that goes and talks about these issues. We don't want anything back. All we want is a better world for all of us.
It is what's right. And I don't think you have to be a Christian or a person of faith at all to do what is right.
That's right.
Pretty simple. Reverend Cynthia Abrams, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was great talking with you. Quick break. Back here at the Families USA Healthcare Conference in Washington, D.C. Quick break. Right back.
Ocean of Red, Rick Smith.
Earth, Sky.
Today, spider brains. The brains of tiny spiders are so large, they fill their body cavities and overflow into their legs.
Researchers at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama measure the central nervous systems of 9 species of spiders, from rainforest giants to spiders smaller than the head of a pin. As the spiders get smaller, their brains get proportionally bigger, filling up more and more of their body cavities.
The researchers said that the smaller the animal, the more it has to invest in its brain power in order to be able to perform fairly complex behaviors, like, in the case of spiders, weaving a web.
They discovered that the central nervous systems of the smallest spiders fill up almost 80% of their total body cavity, including about 25% of their legs.
Some of the tiniest immature baby spiders even have deformed, bulging bodies. That bulge contains excess brain. Adults of the same species don't bulge.
Brain cells use a lot of energy, so small spiders probably convert much of the food they consume into brain power. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. For more on this story, come to earthsky.org and search on the words spider brains. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
I've worked for the state now, helping kids with disabilities. I love the work, make the rules for bosses and you would believe. We had layoffs again this morning. I got my children now that I can see. Parents are angry, how can I blame them? They end up blaming me. When did I become a problem? How did fault become all mine? The governor says, tighten the belt. The only one to tighten is mine.
Wait, that is not the absolute God's honest truth right there. We've got to tighten our belt. And who are we going after? Well, we're going after the very poor. We're going after the working poor. We're going after the working people. And I look at this state senator in Montana, and I guess I better not say this too loudly, because I'm sure our state senators might think of it as well. But he has introduced there in Montana Senate Bill 170, which would reduce the tax levied on the very top income bracket from 6.9 down to 5.9%. They say in the next 2 years it would save them, the wealth class, that 1%, about $125 million over the next 2 years. After that, another $170 million. Guess where that money comes out of? I can guarantee it comes out of education. I can guarantee it comes out of senior services. It comes out of infrastructure. It comes out of, well, out of your pocket. And maybe in Montana they're going to follow the path of our governor, the liquor and lottery, the liquor and lottery economy. That's how we're going to expand the state. That's where the investment's going to be, folks. It's going to be the liquor. We're going to have liquor stores on every corner. I mean, really, stop and think about that for a second. We are in an environment where nearly half of the country is a couple of paychecks away from being in poverty, from being homeless, from being economically destroyed. And yet our governor thinks what we need to be doing, while people are struggling, while unemployment is high, we need to be making vice spending the centerpiece of our economic development. I shudder to think what's next. You know, as I look at this, and this is a report by the Corporation for Enterprise Development. You know, they point out that, you know, almost half of the nation are living on the edge of financial collapse. They say that folks are liquid asset poor. And you know, you go back and you think about this for a while. You know, as I've been saying, with the wage stagnation, what they did is they took away wage increases, and they gave us credit cards, they gave us lines of credit, second mortgages, and now that's all dried up. And what are you left with? Now you're left with wish and hope. Pray that you don't get sick, that your kids don't get sick, that you don't lose the job. And, you know, this plays right into the Romney worldview. You keep people desperate, they're not going to rise up. They're not going to look up from their treadmill. They're not going to stand up and fight back. They're not going to demand better wages, hours, conditions, benefits. None of them. They're not going to do it because they're just existing. And this is what infuriates me. Because all of these attacks are going on, all of this, the push for the no rights at work agenda, the attacks on collective bargaining, the attacks on workers' rights, the attacks on education, health care, our infrastructure, all of that stuff, all of those attacks, we're not fighting back against, I don't think, adequately enough. There should be outrage, there should be people in the streets. And what does our governor give us? We haven't had a transportation bill in 2 years. I still haven't heard his plan for transportation, but I've heard his plan for liquor. Heard that a lot. In fact, we spent all of last year arguing about, should we be privatizing this state asset? I mean, it blows my mind when they, well, that's where money's going to come in. That's how we're going to grow the economy. Instead of doing what we should have been doing all along, which is, building roads and bridges to start. I mean, that's the beginning of it. You know, if you're going to do the drill, baby, drill, which we're doing like mad up in the northwest, especially of the state, shouldn't we be building better roads and bridges? I mean, as I understand it, they're crumbling beneath the weight of the trucks that are on them now. Shouldn't that have been something we thought through? Shouldn't we have planned this a little bit better? And I guess the problem is, and I go back to Corbett's statement yesterday while during the press conference saying that there are a lot of people who know about the private sector in this room, yet they're all politicians. They're all reporters. Where are the people who really, I mean, there are ideologues in that room and a lot of them, but explain to me where the people who actually know. Because most of the entrepreneurs, most of the people that I know who know something about the private sector, you know what they tell me? We need demand. We need people with money in their pockets to spend. And you look at the news yesterday that the economy has contracted and there's some saying, oh, we're going back to recession. I would argue that we have never left the recession. For average, everyday, workaday folks like me, the recession has not ended. Wages are not expanding. Benefits are not expanding. And I look at, you know, why we're here in Washington for this healthcare conference. You know, I want to see healthcare being taken away from employers. I want to see it be something that is an absolute right, not something that a benevolent corporation bestows upon us because, oh, they are so wonderful and trustworthy and we love them so much. And they're doing it because they're patriotic and they love the country. Get out of here. It's nonsensical. If that were the case, everyone would have it. What we're seeing now is a destruction of what my grandparents' generation fought for. It's that simple. Every day we're losing more. Every day there's another one of the cuts of the thousand. Every day. It's a little bit more. Oh, well, we're going to take away collective bargaining. We'll make it a right-to-work state. Oh, you can still organize, but you're going to have to spend money on more reporting. You're going to have to spend more money on this and dwindle your resources down to where you're completely unable to fight back against any of the attacks that are going on right in front of you that are meant to destroy your ability to fight back. Very Machiavellian. And then we have a governor who, well, you know, everything he can do on the ideological vein, everything he can do to push. And there's some who say he's kind of adult. He's not very smart. I think he's really smart. He's not the Chris Christie lightning rod. He's not out there he comes out of his gopher hole every once in a while. I didn't realize it was Groundhog Day yet. But he comes out, he does a quick appearance, and he's back underground. He's burrowing back in. But that doesn't make him any less dangerous. It doesn't make him any less divisive. It doesn't make him any less ideological than the Chris Christies or the Scott Walkers, because the same things are going to happen. It's just we've been lulled by his burrowing back underground. All of that legislation is there. All of those bad ideas right there. It's got to take us, you, me, everybody, staying active, staying engaged, and educated. And understand what the big game plan of this is. The big game plan is Desperation Nation. The big game plan is the workforce of this nation, disposable and desperate. Pretty simple. And for me, I look at this health care law, while flawed in many ways, things that I would like to see much, much greater exposure to, I would like to see much more, it's a step. And, you know, as we talked earlier, had this failed, had this attempt failed, much like it did back in the 90s, had this failed, we wouldn't hear again for another 30 years, I don't think. And then how many uninsured would we have? Would it be 30 million more? Would it be 50 million more? Would eventually the vast majority of us be uninsured? So I'm glad that it passed and actually worked for it to pass. As bad as it was and as much as I think need improvements that need to be done, it's a step in the right direction. We're going to insure 32 million people. That's a step. And for me, that's how we bring down the costs. The other part of this then becomes moving to that next level. You start talking about culturally. There's a cultural change. And part of it's me as well. I mean, my transformation over having had my illness over the summer, making me think a whole lot differently about healthcare and a whole lot differently about health. You know, at the end of the day, it's going to come with a cultural shift. Are we going to continue to allow the big food processors to just lace everything with sugar? Or corn sugar. Love that. I just love that. Are we going to allow that? Are we going to allow corporations to continue to pollute the water, pollute the air, pollute our food supply? That's all part of it. And those are discussions that I hope at some point in the future we have. Because, you know, that's part of our healthcare problem as well. But the big part of it for me is that prevention. Getting folks, go to the doctor every year. You know, I saw a study not too long ago. They said that people who have annual checkups have a longer life expectancy. Why? Because they generally catch illnesses sooner, and they generally get the treatment that they need. Seems reasonable, doesn't it? Seems like probably not a bad idea, right? I think this does a little bit of that. And I think it's a step in the right direction. I'm going to take a quick break right back here at the Families USA Healthcare Conference here in Washington, D.C. Quick break, right back.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show. It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The education battle in Seattle over standardized measures of academic performance, or MAP, tests is escalating, with the Seattle School District threatening 10-day suspensions for teachers unless they administer the tests by February 22nd. Both the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers are supporting the Seattle teachers in their uprising against the MAP tests. NEA President Dennis Van Roekel says it's a defining moment within the education profession as teachers take a stand against what the NEA calls flawed tests not aligned with school curriculums that aren't good for students or teachers. Chris McBride is academic dean at Seattle's Garfield High School.
With me today are just some of the teachers who have decided to take a really strong stand against what we all know is an unnecessary expense and a drain on our very few and precious resources. More importantly, however, our students are not benefiting from this test. In fact, it's hurting many of our students in our most fragile populations, as well as those kids who need more class time, not less class time.
Jesse Agapian is a teacher at Garfield.
We have a different destination here. Teachers at Garfield and schools across Seattle have a different destination for their kids, and that destination is not on the map. Our destination is a destination of creativity. Our destination is a destination of critical thinking. We want to teach our kids to solve real problems that they see in the community, and our stand against this map test is teaching them that.
Hundreds of United Mine Workers of America members and their supporters rallied this week at Peabody Energy headquarters in St. Louis to protest a long-term scheme to strip critical health benefits away from miners, retirees, and their families. UMWA President Cecil Roberts was arrested in the protests. The union says Patriot Coal's bankruptcy case in federal court is being used to take away the hard-earned health benefits of thousands of miners. Patriot was spun off from Peabody. Roberts says this is a sickening display of corporate greed that has overstepped the bounds of decency. He says UMWA will continue to fight so active and retired miners don't have to lay awake at night wondering if they can survive the next week, month, or year without health benefits.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Comment something on your mind, email me rick@therickSmithShow.com. Cannot wait. The Corbett vision of Pennsylvania cannot wait. The liquor and lottery leader of the world. I can't wait till our economy is based on liquor. And because all good things really just come from, you know, people who are liquored up and spending all their money on the lottery. And my next guest is actually from the state of Washington. Maybe she'll have a thought on liquor privatization, since Washington is one of the test cases that I've been looking at. I got Jessica Kendall, Outreach Director for Enroll America. Jessica, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thank you for having me today.
So what do you think? Liquor on every corner? I understand Washington, they privatized their state stores. Not doing as well as they thought.
You know, I think that if you did have liquor on every corner, they should all have some kind of sign saying don't forget to enroll or apply for health insurance in 2013, because as of October 1st, people are going to be able to actually start applying for affordable coverage, and they may be able to get some financial assistance.
And how would we go about this? One of my big concerns about the enrollment process is it's like a lot of enrollment processes in welfare programs, unemployment now, that folks who are at the lower end of the scale, they're going to be the ones who are going to be kind of left out, because it's going to be cumbersome and difficult, and the paperwork and loopholes and red tape and how much of that?
I think that you just perfectly described just about everybody's experience up until this point. And what's really exciting about the changes that are going to happen this year is that it should be a simplified process. People will be able to apply online, over the phone, in person. They can even fill out a paper application, but that's still trying to fill out a paper application. But if people are able to apply online, they're going to be able to experience a marketplace that is user-friendly and simple and compare plans that are affordable and that are transparent and choose the plan that really fits their needs. And all of the plans that are going to be available will cover the care that people need, preventative care, maternity care, vaccines, prescriptions, stuff that people now have to kind of question whether or not it's included in their health insurance plan.
And that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I do like about this is there's going to be a standard level of, or there's supposed to be. I know there's some exemptions for the McDonald's type packages, but for the most part, there's going to be a baseline of care to where you go, oh, that's not covered.
There's going to be a baseline of care, and there's going to be financial help available for those, depending on their income. But the key thing, so there's 40 million uninsured folks out there right now, 40 million. Every state has them. And the key thing is people don't know that there's a coverage available. They don't know where they're going to apply. And you can't create this amazing system and expect people to enroll if they don't know where to enroll. So I think our big opportunity over this next year is making sure people know that there is going to be a coverage available. They can apply as of October 1st. Their coverage will start on January 1st, and then they can actually get the care they need.
Yeah, or the security that they need, because, you know, you just saw the report out yesterday. Almost half of the nation is, you know, a paycheck or two away from poverty, a job loss, an illness. We know this instinctively, but the studies are there. You know, we know so many people, I do at least, mm-hmm. who are a paycheck away from, you know, real trouble.
Absolutely. And I think that healthcare is such an intensely and immensely personal thing, right? It's my health. And when you don't have health care, when you don't have health coverage, you wait to go to the doctor. You push it off until you're really sick.
So yeah, but Jessica, I've got probably the best health care money can buy, and I still do that.
Well, I know that it's common for a lot of people to not want to go to the doctor, but at the same time, there's a difference between pushing it off and also not having the choice because you can't afford it. Knowing that if you go and have a baby or if you break your arm right now, if your child breaks their arm and they're uninsured, it could cost you $10,000.
Oh, tell me.
We don't have, most Americans don't have that kind of extra money laying around.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing is, you know people, I know people who don't have health coverage. And it's important for all of us to make sure that even if we do have it, we need to know there's coverage options available. We need to know where to go to get information. So that way when our neighbor or our friend or somebody in our community group says that they don't have health insurance or we know that they don't, we can let them know where to go. And if people want information, they can go to enrollamerica.org and there's a red button. You can click on the sign up. And they can either sign up to volunteer or to get information. But the only way we're going to get people to get health coverage is if they know to apply.
And we'll make sure to get a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Jessica Kendall's name. It'll take you right there. You know, you brought up this idea of health care for everyone and being able to enroll. And right now, I understand if you have pre-existing conditions. I just met somebody who said, you know, I was turned down for health care about 6 months ago. And, you know, I just don't have it.
Right.
They didn't know that you could go into the high-risk pool and apply for that. So I go, you know, okay, well, this guy didn't know, and this has been in place for some time. Because
mm-hmm.
we live in a state where our governor, he was one of the first people to sign on to the lawsuit against it. So you know that implementation is not high on his list, that getting information out, not high on his list. So, you know, in looking at this, to this point, I'm not enthused at the enrollment process.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping they'll be better as we go forward.
So the first thing that I want to make sure people know is that people will no longer be able to be denied because they have a pre-existing condition. And if somebody has, you know, broken their arm in the past or got in a bike accident or, you know, had cancer, right now to get health insurance is extremely difficult.
Right.
And that's going to change. So I think that that's really important for consumers to know. And then you're absolutely right. It's going to be a challenge to get information out in a lot of places if people don't proactively, who know the information, like you and I sitting here, make sure that people are listening, right? Like, we need to have labor unions. We need to have businesses. We need to have hospitals and schools. If you have access to uninsured folks, spreading the word is going to be the number one important thing to do this next year.
Yeah, I mean, the sad reality is, you look at what we've done in this nation. We've allowed the uninsured, the unemployed, the underserved to be pushed to the periphery, into the corners. We don't have unemployment offices or welfare offices anymore. We do everything on the computer or on the phone. So, you know, for me, I look at, you know, a lot of the folks that I know who are the low-wage workforce, who our governor at the beginning of his term kicked 41,000 people off of the adult basic plan, the very low income health, just very minimal health coverage, booted them to the curb, 88,000 children off of Medicare. Our governor thought, that's a good idea. We're going to boot them off as well. My fear is that we have governors like ours who will continue to do these things, even in the face of what you're talking about.
And states are going to need to decide, especially states like yours, of whether or not they're going to take the money available to actually provide insurance to the most vulnerable of their citizens, or that the feds have already allotted them, or if they're going to give that money back.
Our guy has said no. He's not going to set up the exchange. Nothing. Not doing it. So now it's a federal program. And now, is that an additional layer of bureaucracy? Is that much more difficult, or will it be easier?
I think the most important thing is going to be outreach and education. People don't know about it. So regardless of where you're applying, if you're applying to the state, if you're applying to the feds, you're not going to apply to anybody if you don't know to apply.
Right.
So regardless of who runs that marketplace, you will have one available. And it goes back to people need to know about it.
Because I'd like to see it. You know, you brought it, you just fill out a form, and I initially went to voting. Here you go, you fill out a voter registration form, and how difficult the right has tried to make just filling out that form and being able to vote. And I would like to see, you know, signing up for health insurance as easy as signing up for the right to vote and making health care an absolute right.
I think that people need to be able to apply, and ideally in the simplest way possible. I think that signing up for health insurance, signing up for anything is difficult, right, inherently. Filling out forms is difficult. However, you know, it'll be probably a little bit more complex than voting. Any experiences people have had up to this point of filling out healthcare paperwork, it will be much simpler.
And it's not going to all be just online. I'll be able to actually get a piece, because I'm still kind of analog. Mm-hmm. I still want a piece of paper in front of me. I know you can do it on the computer. I still prefer a piece of paper.
Absolutely. You will be able to apply with a paper application, and if you want assistance, there's going to be assistance available where you can apply in person with a community-based organization that hasn't been decided who it will be, but you'll have opportunities, regardless of what state you're in, to apply in person, over the phone, with a paper application, or online.
And this is the task of Enroll America. Is this a government group, or is this a privately funded public advocacy group?
So with all of the different changes that have taken place, this is one of those guaranteed changes. You can't be excluded because of pre-existing conditions. You have the right to apply online, over the phone, or in person. Enroll America's task is to make sure that people get enrolled in health coverage. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization, and we pull together a bunch of different stakeholders who want to get people enrolled and make sure that we're all reaching out to our groups to make sure it happens.
And as you're talking to different groups, you know, because they're obviously going to be winners and losers in this, and everyone, you know, pointing out who the losers are going to be. And they keep saying the doctors and the hospitals. I don't see it that way. I just saw a story from South Carolina where actually the hospitals are pushing the governor to take the Medicaid expansion money because they do realize it's going to be jobs. It's going to be more people having insurance and more access to health care.
No, I think that, you know, a lot of people have a vested interest in making people get insured, and that is hospitals and health centers and labor unions. I mean, again, if you have access to uninsured folks, either for financial reasons or benevolent reasons, you want to get people health care.
Yeah, you know? But me as a labor guy, one of the things I've always thought is, you know, since we're hell-bent on employer-based care, I've always believed it's one of those things you sit down and negotiate at the bargaining table. But the sad reality is, as we've seen the attacks on labor in this country, that power to negotiate those benefits for not just unionized workers, but the entire workforce has dwindled because of the assault on workers' rights.
And the great thing is that this doesn't change anything with employer-sponsored insurance. If people are getting health insurance right now...
I wish it would, though. And that's just my personal view.
If people are getting it through their employers, this doesn't take away from that. What this does is really give the 40 million folks out there who don't have access to health insurance, it gives them that opportunity to get health coverage.
We see a lot of numbers out there. You've thrown 40 million out. Mm-hmm. I talked to someone earlier who said 50 million. You've seen the 50 million number, 100 million uninsured. At the end of the day, is not what you guys are doing even raising up that 100 million number to that bottom line? Because as you said, there's a minimal level of care that I think the underinsured would benefit from as well.
I think that having access to care will be a benefit to everyone. I think it'll change the health of our communities. You know, I think that right now the latest estimate is there's about 50 million uninsured. About 40 million will be eligible for health coverage through this expansion. But I think that key thing goes back to 40 million. How do you even grasp that number? I think that everybody who's listening to this show, I know myself personally and you, we know uninsured people. We know people who have been denied for coverage in the past who will have access, but they're not going to know to apply unless we make sure they know about it.
And that's the whole point of your group, Enroll America. We've got a link to your website. What's the website again?
It is enrollamerica.org. If you want to sign up and get more information or learn about ways to get involved in your community, feel free to go to enrollamerica.org.
All right, or you can go to therickSmithShow.com, click on Jessica Kendall's name. Take you right there. Outreach Director for Enroll America. Jesse, great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
To the last of us, when will we die? To the kings of the kingdom on high. All hands together for the world. Tell to talk.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Wall Streeters are all a-twitter about the comeuppance of Jamie Dimon, the haughty CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. Last year, poor Jamie presided over a $6 billion loss by the bank's chief investment office. So he's now had his own pay cut in half, knocking him down to $11.5 million. I suppose that's really a come-downance. But by whatever name, having his paycheck whacked by J.P. Morgan's board of directors is widely viewed on Wall Street as a harsh rap on the knuckles. But ask about the board's actions? Dimon himself merely said, "I respect their decision." Of course he does. He walked away with his job intact, an $11.5 million wad in his pocket, and a sly grin on his face. Indeed, many investors and bank regulators, not to mention us commoners, don't consider that level of, quote, punishment to be much of a deterrent to the kind of executive narcissism and carelessness that characterizes today's Wall Street elite. Yet, members of the bank's board are actually puffing out their chests, claiming to be bold bank directors. The vote to cut Dimon's pay, they say, shows that by gollies we're an effective take-charge watchdog over the top management of the nation's biggest bank. That they can even say something so absurd speaks volumes about the laissez-faire myth that corporations don't need government regulation since they have private boards that oversee them. Who are J.P. Morgan's directors? Lee Raymond, for one. In fact, he heads the board's compensation committee and took the lead in giving Dimon his haircut. But Raymond is congenitally gentle on CEO pay because he was a lavishly well-paid corporate chieftain himself. As CEO for ExxonMobil for 13 years, his paycheck totaled $686 million, $144,000 a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, corporate governance is a joke.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, since Monday, you know, you had Zogby giving his little press club luncheon thing, saying, well, you know, we're going to have to pit teachers and against students, teachers against parents, because, you know, the choice that we're given is we're going to have to do something with pensions, and you know what's coming. They're going to slash benefits. They're going to do more to make it harder to get. They're going to do more to try and, well, move it to a defined contribution, one of these 401k type things, so that, well, the security for the teachers not going to be there. And in the long run, when they do this, and they've even admitted when they move to this defined contribution plan, which they seem hell-bent on doing out of pure ideology, nothing more, it's going to cost us, the taxpayers, much more. It's going to give the teachers and the state workers less security, and ultimately, the businesses here in the state less security as well, because that's money that would have been funneled into the local economy anyway. But that's a conversation well beyond what we're going to talk, what most people want to talk about. Understand, the right has this hatred of defined benefits. They do. They don't want to have middle class, working class people to have any sense of security, which is why you see them going after Social Security. You see them going after Medicare. You see them going completely haywire over defined benefit pension plans. And I got this email from Janice, who sent me an article on answering the question, you know, how much should you have in your 401k to retire? Now, I remember when I started a job, you know, back in 93, I think I started there. And I was there almost 18 years. When I left, because they had kind of a hybrid where I had an RIP, this individual retirement plan, which, you know, they would put money into my little name and, they told me when I started, in 30 years, Rick, you're going to have $1 million. 30 years. $1 million. And I looked at them then, and this is back before a lot of the nonsense, and I said, look, they're never going to allow a dumb truck driver to have $1 million. And I've got about 175 now. This is 18 years into this scheme, because you've had a number of market collapses and you've had a number of quote unquote corrections, and it's a nice pot to go after. But Janice sent me this article. And it kind of took me back to when I was looking at 401ks, and because understand we're about 31 years into this experiment, because 401ks have been around since I think 82 was when they popped up. So we're about 30 years into this experiment, and you would think, you go, okay, well, you know, how's it working? We've got 30 years of data. How's it working for people? Understand, back in the 80s when this became we should save for a treasury bill in 1980, about 15% return. Today, if you take out a 30-year treasury bond, you're getting about 3%. So this whole idea of long-term planning for the individual, people like you and me. Now, look, the wealth class, the people who have big money, they're going to be just fine. I'm more worried about people at the bottom of the economic scale. You know, folks who go to work, punch the clock, bust their behinds, and at the end of the week, collect the paycheck. And out of that, they support their families, and out of that, they support their communities, and out of that, they look to trying to save a little bit for retirement. But remember, originally the retirement plan was a three-legged stool. You had Social Security, you had a defined benefit pension plan from your employer, and you had a little bit of savings. Well, they've completely hacked out the defined benefit plan off that stool. So now you got two legs, and wages have been stagnant for 30 years, so that leg's been really shortened, and now they're going after Social Security. And, you know, I love this idea, and the article that she points out, that she sends to me, that just, you go, okay, well, it's a night on paper, again, a wonderful idea on paper, which is they point out that use these inputs. You start a 401k with $1,000. You start working at age 22, making $40,000 a year with a salary that grows at 3% a year every year. I would love to live in this dream world, one. I would, because I don't know an awful lot of 22-year-olds who come out and start making 40 grand a year and are going to get a 3% raise every year on into the future. In fact, I know a lot of people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who aren't making $40,000 a year and haven't gotten a 3% raise in 20 years. So again, what we're being set up to believe is that these 401ks, this is the path to follow. So they go through this whole thing. You're about $40,000 a year. You retire. You contribute 10%. And I'm going, well, how many people right now can afford to save 10%? They're struggling to keep a roof over their heads, struggling to pay gas prices, food prices, all the other things that are going, struggling. So they go, if you do this, you have this $40,000 a year job, that 3% raise each and every year, all of your working years, you contribute 10% of your income into this fund, and you get an annual return of 8% per year, and of course your employer matches the for 6%, which good luck on that anymore, you'll be sitting, according to their calculation, on a nice, tidy $3.1 million 401k. And it is that simple. That's all you have to do. And I look at it and I go, well, again, this scenario, like I've always said, you know, when I coached football, I drew up some beautiful plays that on the field failed horribly. But on paper, boy, they were fantastic. And this is one of those, I agree with you, it's a great idea. On paper, fantastic. Who would be against sitting on, you know, in starting 22, putting a little money away at 66, you're sitting on $3.1 million. You could live off the interest and have a really good living, right? Problem is, it's not happening. So, you know, I went and I looked and I said, you know what? What is the average right now? What's the average? Just the average. I mean, take everybody into the big pot. Because at the end of 2011, according to one of the big firms that follows this stuff, the company's name is the Investment Company Institute. They're a Washington-based trade group that, you know, they basically are the front group for the mutual fund industry. They claim Americans held $3.1 trillion in their 401ks as of the end of 2011. And you go, well, okay, how much does that work out to? And they say, well, you know, about $74,000, $75,000 per worker, per person. And you go, well, that doesn't sound bad, right? Problem is it's not the million that I was told that I was going to get. It's not the 3 million that 3.1 that they said this 22-year-old's going to get, because they say on average you're going to need at least $1 million. So we're not anywhere close to that, right? And I started to look at, and U.S. News and World Report had an interesting little graph a couple years back that kind of walked through some of this stuff. And they said, well, you know, at what level, how much are we looking at as a matter of 401k? And they went through like 20-year-olds at the time, which was back in 2009. And they said, okay, well, these 20-year-olds who've been on the job, you know, 5-10 years, they have about an average of $18,000 in their 401k. You move up into people into their 30s, and you go, okay, you've been there 5-10 years, they've got about $40,000 in their 401k. People with 10-20 years of service, you know, $60,000, somewhere in that range. You jump up into the people in their 60s. And these are the people who have been in this 401k for quite some time. People you would think, they have some money set aside. People with 20, 30 years worth of service, $172,000 in their 401k. People above and beyond that 30, $210,000. And you go back and you go, well, wait a second. I thought you need $1 million to retire. Because, understand, these 401ks, this is it. That defined benefit plan that used to be that my grandparents' generation retired with, that's gone. That's been begged, borrowed, and thefted away. That's been written off in bankruptcy. That's been, as Alan Simpson said, you know, it's been spent. You know, it's gone. You know, he was talking about Social Security. Sorry, the money's all gone. We spent it. So we've allowed this system that worked fairly well. We've allowed this system that worked fairly well for a couple of generations to be completely eviscerated and in the name of greed. Because I remember, guys, and I go back to when I started, when it happened to me, this idea that, oh, we're going to have $1 million. Oh, I'm going to be rich. And I remember saying to the guys in the room with me, it's not going to happen. Give me the defined benefit plan. Tell me when I turn 65 at the end of X amount of years, how much I'm going to get from this and how it's going to be there every year thereafter until I die. And I was told, oh, no, you're crazy. You're crazy, Rick. They're putting all this money into there. And I go, yeah, trust me. This is the way you get one of the sheep away from the herd. And this was the beginning of it. And they're going to do the same thing with the state pension plan. It's not going to be for this generation. And the hope is from the Republican point of view. The hope is that they can turn around and they can get the current workforce to go, you know what? I don't really care about my kids. I don't care about the next generation coming up after me. I don't care if they have retirement security or health security. Don't care about that. Care about me here and now. Surprisingly, that view, I mean, it's been 30, 40 years of indoctrination of hooray for me and screw everybody else. We're finally walking away from. Because I think we do now understand. Hooray for me and screw everybody else means we all get screwed. Because there's no hooray for me. And I go back to this $75,000 number, the average value of the average 401k. And that's just the big pot of money, the $3.1 trillion in 401k money divided up by everybody who has one. You look to the very top of the scale. Who has their fully funded pension, their fully funded 401k? Well, the people at the very top who can afford to put every dime in every year. It's not that worker at the local fast food joint or the big box retailer who puts in a couple of bucks a year because that's all they can afford, and they end up with 10 or 15. The one number I saw here in Pennsylvania, 18,000 is the average 401k when you take out that top tier. So when people retire, 18,000, what is that going to get you? Well, nothing, because, you know, according to the story that Janice sent me, you know, you want to live off the interest. And, oh, by the way, like I said, the Treasury, 3%. So if you got $18,000, you got $20,000, 3% of that per year, what are you getting? Not a lot. A couple of hundred bucks a year until you got to delve into the principal, and then how long is that going to last? They are setting us up, and they've been setting us up, so that we're easily exploitable and desperate. And, of course, they get to keep the vast majority of the wealth that we used to have. And that's what's frustrating about this whole thing to me. Because there was a time where we got it. And I think back to my grandparents, and I got to be honest, you know, the whole 401k thing, when I explained to my grandfather, I said, this is what they're telling me. And he instinctively, you know, and I agree, I was there before he was, because it was laid out to me before I explained it to him. He said, it's a ripoff. And I'm telling you, we have got to get back to those days. We have got to get back to the days where we, as a working class, and you know what? I'm tired of worrying about the upper echelon. They're going to be fine. You look at the Great Recession, you look at all of the economic downturn, they're back. They're happy. They're as happy and as healthy and as wealthy as they have ever been. And paying less tax than they've ever paid. Even with the huge, massive, enormous tax increase that's going to make people flee the country and Phil Mickelson leave the state of California. Oh, they're going to tax me. It's nonsense. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, spider brains. The brains of tiny spiders are so large they fill their body cavities and overflow into their legs.
Researchers at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama measure the central nervous systems of 9 species of spiders, from rainforest giants to spiders smaller than the head of a pin. As the spiders get smaller, their brains get proportionally bigger, filling up more and more of their body cavities.
The researchers said that the smaller the animal, the more it has to invest in its brain power in order to be able to perform fairly complex behaviors, like, in the case of spiders, weaving a web.
They discovered that the central nervous systems of the smallest spiders fill up almost 80% of their total body cavity, including about 25% of their legs.
Some of the tiniest immature baby spiders even have deformed, bulging bodies. That bulge contains excess brain. Adults of the same species don't bulge.
Brain cells use a lot of energy, so small spiders probably convert much of the food they consume into brain power. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. For more on this story, come to earthsky.org and search on the words spider brains. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
We are here in Washington, D.C., the Hyatt Hotel, the capital. We're here in the Hyatt. You know, I look at this, and I think this has been our fifth, maybe our sixth year coming out here to the Families USA conference. That's always great to come out because we get to speak to folks who, this is what they do. They're the experts on it. We hear a lot of distortions. We hear a lot about death panels and federal takeover and all kind of nonsense, but But the reality is, this is where the facts are. This is where the information is. And I'm sitting here with Phil Villers, co-founder and president of Families USA, the people putting on this radio row. Phil, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure, Rick.
You know, we come out here, we've been out here several years in a row, and it's, I always learn something new. There's always something that I come away with. I gotta be honest, I was not a huge fan of Obamacare. Because I didn't think it went far enough. Straight from the bottom, I was a single-payer guy. Thought it had been so much easier to open up Medicare and allow me to choose between a private plan and Medicare. Just seemed to be the simple way. But we're going this route, and might as well give it a shot, right?
Well, in fact, the tradition in our country, for good or for worse, is we take one step at a time. This was a giant step after 100 years of working to do it, but it's not the last step.
Yeah, and this isn't one of those Churchill things, is it? That Americans always do the right thing?
After
doing everything else first?
In a way.
So tell me, Families USA, the founding of this, give me a little history of the organization and the direction that you guys are following.
Sure. I happen to be trained as an engineer, founded 3 high technology companies, the first of which became one of the 500 largest companies. And that created the financial means to fulfill a lifelong dream of making a difference in this country, a difference on something that mattered, and we chose healthcare. I approached Ron Pollack 30 years ago to become the executive director, and we've worked together ever since to bring about quality, affordable healthcare for every American. And it's taken us 30 years, with a lot of allies, of course, and we're very proud of the Affordable Care Act as a giant step in the right direction, but not the last step.
Right. And you know, one of the things, as someone who's created jobs, as someone who, you know, as you said, fortunate, one of the big 500 companies, you know, I've always wondered why it is that employers want to be saddled with the health care thing. I don't think it's something that employers should have to do. They should be able to do their business. I mean, I've always wondered why it is we seem hell-bent on the employer-based system.
Well, the history, it was a way of getting around price controls in World War II. So we still are the prisoner of that decision in World War II, but we're moving away from it gradually. You know, we have Medicare, we have Medicaid, we have the Veterans Administration. Step at a time.
Step at a time. And it's groups like yours who advance that step forward, and we'll continue to fight for this, correct? I mean,
yes.
Because we're not done here. This isn't the end of the road.
No. The biggest challenge now is we have the world's most inefficient healthcare system, unfortunately, and we can't afford to have it keep growing twice as fast as the cost of living. So controlling quality and cost and improving them is the next big challenge. The only other alternative is the meat axe that some right-wing folks would like to do by just slashing everything and letting every individual go on his own. We want to reform the system in ways that help, not hurt. And we know it can be done. Other countries have done it.
Yeah.
We've got to do something about perverse incentives, where the more a doctor orders, the more money he makes. We've got to do something about the pharmaceutical industry.
The profit motive that's in healthcare. It's always been fascinating to me that we have a healthcare industry that benefits, and shareholders benefit from my misfortune.
Well, Massachusetts, in this respect, where I live, almost all our healthcare hospitals are not for profit. Not a bad thing.
No, I'm absolutely in favor of it. I mean, community hospitals are part of the community and should be for the benefit of the community, I believe. And we used to have a system like that.
And we're gradually also moving towards a tiered system of the right kind, where there are local clinics, which are essentially the first line of defense. Even drugstores are doing simple things like giving shots. And that leads to a more efficient, more user-friendly, and less expensive system.
Yeah, I look at our governor, who is privatizing our liquor stores as we speak, because we're going to live in the state of liquor and lottery. Pennsylvania will be the number one state. If you want to buy lottery tickets, we'll have them easily available, probably in kindergarten very soon, if our governor gets his way. But here's a guy who's talking about choice. It's all about consumer choice, except in healthcare. I mean, and we haven't done a lot of the things that you just said. If my kid's sick on a Saturday evening, there's nowhere for me to go but to the emergency room. If someone, a low-income folk who don't have insurance, they don't have a family doctor, where do they end up? They end up in the ER, the most expensive way of getting health care.
Right. And also, choice means informed choice. We haven't had that. How many of your listeners, when the doctor talked about an expensive procedure, said, "I want 3 bids"?
Well, do we do that? I mean, and should I be doing that? As I'm laying on the ground, having a heart attack, do I have the local hospital on speed dial to see who's taking a coupon?
My answer to that is dream on.
It's never going to happen, but I did hear a commercial for one of the big for-profit health insurance companies saying that they've got an app that will tell you exactly how much every procedure that you're having cost you in real time.
That's a step in the right direction.
Is it? I mean, I'm laying on my deathbed going, oh no, that's going to cost too much.
Well, it means you won't make a different decision, but publicizing prices, which is not true today, put all sorts of pressures, including employer pressures, on providers. So
that's a good point.
Transparency is very important. No, when you're on the deathbed, you're not going to say which of 3 procedures you're going to have. You're going to follow your doctor's advice.
Yeah, but in looking at this, do you think the Affordable Care Act, do you think Obamacare is going to bring about something of a cultural shift in that people will go to the doctor more often? Because I know at the very beginning of it, I had people saying, people will be going to the doctor, and I'd be going, well, that's probably a good thing. A little prevention? A little thought?
Prevention is a major thrust and needs to be in bringing costs down and healthier Americans. And we've got a lot of preventive steps that everybody knows we could take and haven't taken as a country. Other countries have, and that's part of the mix.
Yeah, I mean, you look at some of the infection rates that are of some of our hospitals.
Well,
I mean, it's mind-blowing that there are countries like Cuba who've done a pretty good job of eliminating staff infections and MRSA and all these other...
Well, this is a perfect example. The Affordable Care Act penalizes hospitals for frequent readmissions. Good idea.
Yeah, I'm with you. The last part of it is that hasn't really taken on is the electronic records, and I know that was a part of it. Why hasn't that worked out to this point as well as anticipated?
It's far more complex than most people realize. Ultimately, it'll be a big winner, but Rome was not built in one day.
Yeah, good point. You know, in this economy, you know, one of the things that I keep focusing on are the jobs. And, you know, you expand the Medicaid, you expand this program. We could be creating, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of jobs and decent paying jobs.
Absolutely. Because we're not going to actually reduce the cost of health care in an absolute sense. What we're going to do is to make sure that the rate of growth does not outpace the rate of growth of the economy, because otherwise by 2050 we'd spend half of our gross national product on health care. Ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, the thing that gets me is, you know, and I haven't heard anybody talk about this yet. Maybe you'll have an idea. You know, we spend twice as much as every other industrialized nation in the world. Does that mean this is going to help pull that back, or will it mean we're just not going to spend triple everybody else?
I'd like to say something else, but the honest truth is we're not actually going to roll back the cost. We're just going to make sure that they stop growing faster than the economy, and that's going to be an enormous improvement, because the alternative is the meat axe. Look at the kinds of thing Representative Ryan is proposing.
Yeah, that's
essentially cut, 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 and the devil take the hindmost.
Yeah, slash and burn. It makes no sense. But in the process, we may not be triple, but we're going to cover 40 million more, 32, 40 million more people.
That's
reasonable.
That's what we're going to do, and we're going to make it a better system for us, the patients.
Well, I'm hoping that you're right, and I'm hoping this is unrolled. The rollout works well. The implementation works well. I'm fortunate, and I'm glad that our governor chose not to get involved in setting up the exchange. I'll take my chances with the federal one, and I think a lot of states probably feel the same way with their insane governors. Phil, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time, and thanks for having us here at your conference.
Rick, a pleasure to talk to you.
Phil Villers, co-founder and president of Families USA, the folks who are putting on this health care conference. Quick break, back from Washington, D.C. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. On the talk.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, Loyal owned only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Fun. So fun with the tea party. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Of course, if you missed any portion of the broadcast, you can download the podcast there from the website or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go here in Washington, D.C. for the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I look at this and I think back of the whole debate, the whole passage of this law, and I can't get my Tea Party dentist out of my mind, who constantly tells me, well, they rammed it down my throat. They rammed that. And I'm going, it took an entire year. There were numerous committees. There were numerous bills. All this stuff. This has got to be the longest ram down in history. And then he follows up, well, right at the end. I'm going, oh, yeah, right at the end when they actually passed the vote. That was when they rammed it down. And let's not forget the lengthy court battles and all of this stuff. And as I look at all of this whole process, for me, the simple solution right from the very beginning, and I will still stay with this, even though it's not going to happen, would have been just very simply open up Medicare. It would have been that simple. Give me choice. And I know our governor has consumer choice. You want to give me real choice? Give me real choice. And what I like about the affordable is they're going to have plans that are going to be, you're going to have a minimum at least, and you can choose from, pick and choose. That gives you some choice. Our governor doesn't want you to have that. Our governor wants you to have the choice of liquor, wants you to have the choice of lottery, and I've been stuck on that all day today because it inflames me. It infuriates me to think that that's the direction that they want to take us. Vice spending. That's going to somehow support our economy. Vice spending is going to turn this state around. There's no jobs plan. And you look at what could create jobs. Investments in education. Investments in infrastructure. Still, no transportation bill. 2 years, nothing. Investment in health care. They're not going to touch the implementation of the exchange. And I guess no Medicaid money either, which I got to tell you, I think is economic malpractice. And while I'm a political vein, I'm hoping it turns around and bites him because I see him as a one-term governor. All of this has got to play with Republicans. And we talked about the polling out that says, look, this guy's not very popular, even among Republicans who don't think he should be reelected. And you go, this is why. At the end of the day, the bottom line to all of this are the jobs that we need, the jobs that are going to turn all of our problems around. That's the answer. You need a silver bullet. You need the wonder drug. That's it. Jobs. Get the people back to work, even if government has to be the employer of last resort, even if it has to be the one who says we're going to expand educational opportunities, because we know that's going to, A, create jobs in the short term, but have a better opportunity in the future for all of our citizens. Not the direction that we're going, not constriction, not slash and burn, not cut, gut, and punish. Not, that's not it. And we just saw yesterday with the numbers that came out, the economy had contracted. Why? Well, because we're gutting investment. And it's something we've really got to be working on. And we've got to be pushing back against. So, again, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's the best place to go to get the podcast. Again, Stitcher, Stitcher, Stitcher. on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. I'm interested in your thoughts, your comments. Tomorrow we will be back here at the Families USA Healthcare Conference. Interested in your thoughts, your stories, your questions, your comments. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. We'll be back tomorrow right here from Washington, D.C., Families USA Healthcare Conference. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on